Hello, welcome to the September 27th edition of Beamcast, the official ShonenBeam.com podcast. My name is Jean.
My name is Drew.
My name is Clint.
And we said last week that we weren't going to be on this week, but we missed you guys so damn much. We just couldn't take a week off, of course. So we're back, unexpectedly, but pleasant surprise, I hope. We want you to get on the Shonen Beam social network. We are on Facebook, Twitter, MyAnimeList, IRC. And as always, please feel free to email the show, ShonenBeam@gmail.com. Very little news this week, but a couple notes here. Oh My Goddess will be receiving a new original anime DVD, which will ship with the 42nd volume of the manga. We don't exactly have too many details on what the original anime DVD will contain. We do know that Hiroaki Goda is directing the project, and the theme song will be sung by Fripside. That's about all the info we have, but it's a little nice piece of info there for Oh My Goddess fans. A non-shonen piece of news, but a very exciting one, Genshiken is coming back. Genshiken 2 will return in the November issue of, there's an announcement that in the November issue of Kodansha's monthly afternoon magazine that Genshiken will return as Genshiken Nidaime, or Genshiken 2. We don't exactly have too many details. We do know that the new club president, Ogiue, will be trying to hang on to new students. And we do know that Hato, who is the cross-dresser, will also appear. Thoughts on whether this is a good thing for the series overall?
I feel like it could be fun to read, but I don't know what it's going to add to Genshiken past how phenomenal the last 20 chapters of the series were.
Yeah, I don't know that it could really add anything to how good it was, but I mean, if it's more of the things that I enjoyed, it's always going to be good.
Right. I've heard rumors that it's going to be kept fairly short. I can't confirm or deny that, but I've heard some people say it might even only be like 5 chapters or so. If it's that small, surely there won't be too many major plot points. So it'll just be a little bit more of the comedy that we enjoyed from a fantastic series. So that I'd be mostly okay with. Oricon rankings for September 13th through the 19th. The top 5 are Chihaya Furu, number 10. Number 2 is Hajime no Ippo, 93. Number 3 is Flat, number 4. 4 is Gantz, number 29, and 5 is Hanakimi After School. Some of the major shonen of note on here, obviously Ippo 93 at number 2 is the most notable. Major number 77 has placed at number 8. Arya no Kishi at 22, or number 22 at 11, pardon me. Yankikun to Meganichan 19 at 15. Also on here is Rinne, the new Rumiko Takahashi series, volume 5 at 21. The World God Only Knows number 10, just the regular volume is at 25, and then the DVD bundle limited edition is at 28. There's also a DVD bundle for Major 77 at 26. And finally, number 30 is Cage of Eden, which, by the way, of note, the Scanlation, I think it's Red Hawk doing that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're getting there. They finally cracked, they released chapter 50 this past week, which is the first the chapter they've released from this calendar year. So keep up the good work, guys.
Almost there.
Yeah, we're getting there. release dates for this upcoming week. We have Season 6 Uncut, the box set of Bleach on DVD for $49.95. That is the beginning of the Aruncar arc. Thoughts on that particular segment of the series? Still acceptable in the anime?
Still fairly acceptable. Well produced enough, I would say, at least.
Well, you could pretty well say that.
You can say that about any part of Bleach, I know, but this was before the series went to Mexican Afterlife and got really bad in terms of pacing.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty good. It's uncut for all of you that like to see swear words in your subbing.
Fullmetal Alchemist, the first season Viridian collection on DVD for $49.98. Also, Nabari no O, the modern day ninja series. Complete series is on DVD for $59.98. I thought that was a rather enjoyable series, which I didn't actually finish. I got about 18 episodes in and then kind of lost interest.
Yeah, I got. I was reading the manga following that through, and I got quite a few chapters in and I didn't finish it myself, but it was a new take on ninjas, a take on ninjas that was not Naruto.
Yeah, I thought it was a really fresh approach. It's just when it was getting really bogged down into the relationship between the two male protagonists, which if you're familiar with the story, you'll know what I'm talking about. When it got too drama centric, I started to lose my focus on it.
Yeah, it peddled a little too much in yaoi bait.
Yeah, you could very easily say that. Manga side of releases this upcoming week, Volume 3 of Dead Man Wonderland for $10.99, worth a pickup?
Go out there and buy it. You have to get this series. By all means, get the first two volumes first, but
really?
Follow it. Follow the series. It deserves it.
Pro tip from Clint, don't start from Volume 3. Thank you, sir. Fairy Tail Volume 12 for $10.99. Fairy Tail overall, that's definitely way back when the series was still consistently good.
This is before, like, things that made it less enjoyable. It's definitely a pretty enjoyable part of Fairy Tail. I would recommend it.
All right, last week's poll, we actually forgot to touch on the poll itself in the discussion segment, but the poll was, how do you prefer to read manga? And the options that we've given you were localized volume releases, online scanlations, and original raws. Once again, we're having to record the show early, so we cannot give you a final tally of results, but as of right now, the favorite, the winner here, is online scanlations with about 62% of the vote. Following that is localized volume releases with about 32% of the vote. And then after that, we actually got two votes for original raws. That's pretty cool. Whoever you are, pat yourself on the back. That's pretty awesome that you're out there. How do you guys prefer to read manga?
I do like official volume releases. I like having the paper in my hands to read.
I'm all about speed. I mean, accuracy is kind of an issue, but online scanlations are mainly what I go with.
I would prefer localized volume releases if I could be perfectly happy with the translation at all times. And I've, with specific regard to One Piece, I've just not been pleased with their localization, for example. So I'm kind of a mix between the two. Predominantly, I do read online scanlations first. So I suppose out of convenience, I'd have to pick that one. Thank you very much to everyone who voted in that poll. Our new poll for this upcoming week celebrates the fact that One Piece is back this week. Certainly when this show goes up, it will not be back right away. But within a couple days, we should have that chapter on manga stream, I would guess. So regarding One Piece, then, our poll question to you is, what is your favorite One Piece arc? And the options we are giving you are the entire East Blue Saga as a whole, which includes the early portions all the way through the Arlong Park arc, and we'll include Loguetown as well and all of that. Then Baroque Works, Skypiea, CP9, also referred to as Water 7 / NES Lobby, Thriller Bark, and then the overarching War Saga. So out of those six options, what would you consider your personal favorite?
NES Lobby. I mean, the War Arc was big. Skypiea was pretty fun. But NES Lobby was, to me, the most impactful arc.
I mean, I think that's what I said back when we recorded our first show, that you could make a case for the War Arc, but really, NES Lobby is the best One Piece arc, easily.
I have to concur with both of you. I will say that I am a really, really noted fan of Skypiea. I think that it's a brilliant piece of storytelling, a contained storytelling, but ultimately just the CP9, Water 7, NES Lobby arc was just so powerful, did so much for the entire ensemble cast. I really, really adore that arc. But that is our opinion. We'd be more than happy to hear your opinion, so we hope that you will vote in that poll. Now it is time to move on to the Great Shonen Tier List. Very briefly, I would like to point out, in case it was not already apparent, this is a very, very spoiler-intensive segment. So bear in mind that if you disagree with our explanations as to why a character should be somewhere, we totally respect that. Just be aware that to properly explain something, we are going to have to spoil you. So, be patient with us in that regard. This week, we're going to begin with One Piece. We're going to begin with Rob Lucci, speaking of the CP9 arc, come to think of it. Rob Lucci, who is the head of CP9, or I suppose the most powerful member in CP9, technically Spandam is the head of CP9. Rob Lucci's powers include Rokushiki, the martial arts. A notable subset of that includes basically double jumping endlessly, extreme speed, Tekkai, which enables you to withstand blows. Just a wide variety of martial arts style moves. And he also did eat the leopard fruit. He ate a zone fruit, so he can turn into a leopard. And he uses that to augment his existing strength and speed. So then looking at the existing tier list, and I want to take a look. He's not going to be elite, probably not even high tier. So let's look at the bottom half of strong tier. In fact, the bottom trio of strong tier. And Clint, let me get your thoughts on versus Setsuna from Negima.
I think Setsuna just has a wide variety of techniques. She's very powerful. Looking in specifically the chapter we just received this week of Negima that we'll talk about later, she showcases quite a bit of strength. I think she's more than capable of dealing with what is essentially an unarmed opponent.
Right. Kyle from Siren, Drew?
Kyle from Siren, I feel that personally he has, in addition to, like, really enhanced physical strength, he has the ability to jump in the air via his boxes, and he is psychically augmented, not just, like, trained to a ridiculous extent, but he is, like, augmented psychically. I feel like he has an edge over Lucci in this battle. I don't feel like it's decisive, but it's an edge.
Both of you, very briefly, do you think we're looking in about the right area, below all these other One Piece characters like Luffy and Hancock and Crocodile?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tommy Rod, then. What would you make of that fight, Clint?
I think there's just an overwhelming number of bugs. I mean, even with the wide area of attack techniques that he has based on their martial arts, I don't think he can deal with all the bugs that Tommy Rudd can pull out.
Even with something like a Ronkyaku?
Yeah, I just don't think it's enough.
Okay. So that would then likely bump him down to mid-tier, but I'm guessing he's not going to go too far near the too far down the mid-tier. What about Kazuma from Scryde, Drew?
Kazuma from Scryde, this is, again, a pretty tough call. I think as far as physical endurance goes, Kazuma sort of has the edge in that category, and additionally, you see Kazuma having, like, full body armor via his alter power. So I just don't feel like Ryushi would be able to penetrate his armor and do anything about that.
His two primary attacks in that sense to try to penetrate that armor would probably be the Rokugan and Shigan. And yeah, Shigan decidedly would not penetrate the armor. Rokugan is kind of, the way I interpret it, was kind of a shockwave being sent out, and you don't feel that that would take him out?
I don't feel like, it might get through the armor, but I don't feel that a shockwave attack would be sufficient to kill Kazuma.
Okay, now looking next up are a couple series that I read, Air Gear and Reborn, looking at Kazu and Suna. And I don't know, I'm starting to feel like just the strength reserves that he has, the wide array of different style of moves, I kind of think this is about where he falls. Would you tend to agree with that?
I would feel at the very least he can sit through anything Suna's got, just with Tekkai, and then just, like, the bullet finger through Suna, I feel that would be fatal if he got it.
I don't even think he would have to actually take Suna's attacks because he's so fast. He'd be able to get around him. Granted, Suna does have, like, the rocket propulsion style of thing, but as weird as it is to try to quantify, I just feel as though Lucci is faster. Certainly he's not faster than Kazu, but when you're looking at Kamiya, which is the dodging part of the Rokushiki, I think that he'd be able to dodge all the different, like, joint paralysis strikes that Kazu has to offer. And that's about all that Kazu has to offer. Yeah, he has, like, the flames, but they're not really used in an offensive manner like Asuna, so I just don't think that he'd be able to do anything to Lucci. So, if we have no complaints, is this where Rob Lucci goes, right below Kazuma?
Yeah, splitting up our two Kazumas seems about right.
Damn it. We had our perfect little Kazuma duet right there for, like, 1 week. It's gone now. All right, Lucci goes right below Kazuma. Next up, from Naruto, there's not an immediately relevant character that we feel comfortable tiering. It's still too early to tier Madara because we just don't know the full extent of his powers. So it gives us a chance to go back and look at an underappreciated character, and this week we'll look at Nara Shikamaru, who is certainly one of the most interesting characters in all of Naruto. And I think let's start in the mid-tier again for Shikamaru. Let's take a look at... Well, we have a couple of different Naruto characters in this tier, Rock Lee and Sakura. Clint, what are your thoughts on where Shikamaru would fall in relation to those two?
I think right in between them. I think Rock Lee's a little too fast and too strong for the technique Shikamaru uses to overcome that. But at the same time, I think Shikamaru definitely has an edge over someone like Sakura just by sheer breadth of his techniques and what he's able to do and his creativeness in using them.
Would you tend to agree with that, Drew?
I guess I agree with that. It took me a little while to think it over, but yeah, I think that, like, Shikamaru, with, like, the techniques he's seen over the time skip, has improved more than Sakura has and was originally stronger.
Decidedly. Originally, yeah, there's no question. All right, so then looking in the middle there, that gives us a window about seven or so characters, six characters, I believe. Right in the middle, let's take a look at Tokine from Kakashi. We have a couple different Kakashi characters. Let's look at Tokine first. Drew, your thoughts
Tokine
on Shikamaru?
Primarily, my feeling was that if the fight dragged on, Shikamaru would have the advantage, but I also get the feeling that Tokine is a very no-nonsense fighting character. There's nothing to stop her from really just putting a nail-shaped Kakai right through him the instant the fight starts, which she would do.
And he wouldn't really have any particular answer to that. That makes sense to me. What about Toriko, Clint?
I think Toriko's the kind of character that is just overpowering amount of strength. I don't think the shadow techniques would be able to bind or hold him or strangle him.
Okay, now what about, let's see, Iki? Iki is exceptionally fast, but, I mean, Shikamaru later on in the series was shown to use the technique where he kind of puts his shadow into the seals, like the paper seals, throw them all around with the kunai or the knives that he inherited from Asuma, so he could kind of summon the shadows from all sorts of different places. To me, that feels as though he would have a decided battleground advantage over Ikki. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think like being able to set things up, putting shadow hands all around the battlefield, and eventually if one of them gets Ikki's leg, it's not like he's a fantastically strong human. He's like a brawler strong, but not like
right.
break out of mystical shadows strong.
Exactly. And that would then put him above Asuna of Negima. Would you tend to agree with that?
Yeah, I would pretty much agree with that.
I think that's fair enough.
All right. So that's going to end up putting Shikamaru right below Toriko and right above Ikki. Our next character is Vegeta. Vegeta from Dragon Ball. And obviously we're looking far up the list. You're going to think he's closely related to Goku, aren't you?
Yeah, well, but based on how we've rated Goku, Vegeta can't go right next to him.
Based entirely on instant transmission?
Instant transmission, yeah.
Okay, yeah, and that he was never shown to have that. So, instant transmission is really the trump card against time stopping, so he at least goes below Jotaro. What about Negi?
Nicky's an interesting situation. I think he's maybe faster than Vegeta. Maybe not more firepower, but more breadth of technique. And I think his speed combined with that will be enough to give him an edge.
Okay. Kenshiro, is there any reason to believe that Vegeta could hit the intangible?
No.
I don't think so. Nero from Majin Tante no Gami Nero. Again, reflector, evil reflector, summoned up, reflect away, probably a Kamehameha or you know, Big Bang, like, or whatever.
He doesn't have a way through reflector, and evil metal is, like, more or less a sure kill. Getting sliced in half is something that human, like, realistic characters can't survive.
What about Hyobu?
Hyobu? That is a bit of a tougher call, I think.
DBZ like, characters, yeah. Especially Goku, and has been shown to be killed with a heart attack.
That is true.
Oh, there you go. That's not... not at all unreasonable to say could happen. Would Vegeta have an answer to Vectors?
No, not at all.
You agree with that?
I don't think so.
Amamiya, then, from Siren, she gets the free hit because she can split her body into the two different bodies, and she can read minds. Is that still enough to take out someone as strong as Vegeta?
Well, it's strong enough when you take in when you take into account the fact that she can create illusions fairly easily, and... I think you can assume within a fair degree that, like, Vegeta can be sliced in half with, like, the insanity scythe that she has.
Mm-hmm. Enaru?
This is where it gets down to being interesting. I mean, Vegeta does have those kind of in-every-direction, huge area-of-effect blasts that we're assuming can connect with Logia users.
He certainly would have whatever the Haki equivalent is across different series universes. There's no question that if he were to strike Enaru, it would hurt. I don't feel there's any question there whatsoever. It's just that Enaru is able to move at the speed of electricity, so he certainly can move behind Vegeta in an instant. But I believe that Vegeta has some kind of massive area of effect attack, doesn't he?
Vegeta has an explosion attack that he uses a couple of times throughout the series, Big Bang attack aside, that, like, just everything around him explodes. It will affect him as well, but I get the feeling that, like, taking a solid punch with Haki to the degree that Vegeta can deliver is enough to take Enel out and will take him out faster.
Okay, and that would then put him above Aoi and Kisuke. Are we okay with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Vegeta... yeah, that's quite a bit of distance between him and Goku, but that...
He's always going to be number two.
It feels rather appropriate to me.
Yeah, I mean, based on the teleport, I mean, having a teleport is a huge issue.
Absolutely. Okay, so Vegeta goes right below Amamiya of Siren, but above Enaru of One Piece. Next up in the tier list this week is Sagara Sanosuke from Rurouni Kenshin, and that is entirely Clint territory, so I imagine we're looking pretty far down the list from where we just were.
Yeah, we're looking quite a bit down the list. He's not going to be up... In the top part of the list, like the characters we've just been tiering.
How do you feel about him in relation to the Kenshin characters that we already have? We've already tiered Kenshin himself, Shishio Makoto, and Saito Hajime.
He's very much a couple steps down from all of them. The sword users in the series are just a bit stronger than he is. He generally gets paired with weaker enemies.
Okay, so we're looking low tier, do you think?
Yeah, I would think so.
All right, let's start at the top of low tier, because we still want to stay rather close to the other Kenshin characters for now. Kurenai Shinkuro.
Kurenai is just the same type of character. He has a very strong punch, perhaps stronger than Sano's, and he is also quite a bit more durable than Sano is, so I would give that to Kurenai.
He's got bones.
He does.
That does it. And so does Brook, but Brook gets the free hit because he can put opponents to sleep, so put Sano to sleep and stab him in the heart.
Yeah.
pretty much. Hayate no Gotoku, what do you think?
It's interesting. I mean, he's got all the comic hero attributes that we always talk about. He's definitely fast enough to avoid punches, I would think.
Yeah, that to me is it. I think that if Sana were to connect, it would certainly damage him. I don't know about kill him. I'm not sure one way or the other. I just don't think he's going to.
Yeah.
Akinojiro from Hajiyaku.
That is kind of an interesting fight. I think that Jiro with the cape has more versatility and attack options than just a brawler does.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. What about Oga Tatsumi, the main character of Beelzebub?
Yeah, this is getting even more interesting. I mean, we're seeing a situation even closer to characters between these two than we did with Kurenai.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Oga's punch has a supernatural tinge to it that even though Sano's punch has a physics-defying tinge to it...
you know what, come to think of it, we didn't actually explain exactly what it is that he does for the sake of anyone who isn't familiar, so go ahead and blow their minds with this.
Futaya no Kiwami is a punch that connects twice, once with the middle knuckle and then again with the knuckle closest to your hand, and connecting twice in rapid succession means the first hit breaks the guard, kind of, and the second hit delivers a hit that's not impeded by any kind of armor or resistance.
Which... I just to kind of elaborate opinionated on this, I kind of feel like that is a very interesting concept in and of itself for the sake of fighting like a human opponent who perhaps subconsciously, you know, the body could react to the initial strike and then the follow-up strike is completely unguarded.
Kind of like a flinch and a relax, that makes sense.
Right, but he uses it to blow up rocks.
Yeah.
Maybe he just punches once that good.
He blows apart rocks, yeah. And then later on, he evolves the two-hit technique into a three-hit technique that works like a fist bump and then blow up the hand.
So he's just a bro.
Yeah.
He does the double punch and then opens up the hand, so he's a cool kid. All right, that's great. So, anyway, Sano versus Oga, your thoughts finally?
Yeah, I think Oga takes it just based on the supernatural...
Yeah.
Supernatural side of his power.
There's just... We haven't re-tiered Oga yet based on the full extent of the blast radius that he was able to achieve when he did, like, full power against Kyuria, I think his name was.
Yeah.
But, you know, even before that, there's a bit more of the blast around it, I just feel, would make the difference.
He did demolish an entire school.
That's true. So he can also break rocks. Gilbert Kent from Hayate. What about him?
He's got a mech. That's why he's here, but I don't think the mech is going to stop Futaya no Kiwami from just smashing it into a million pieces.
Because that mech's going to relax after the first hit.
Right.
Because it's a comedy mech.
Oh, I'm okay now.
It's overworked. It's got a 9-to-5 day job, clock punching and everything.
So that would put Sano between Oga and Gilbert. That puts him above Usopp, Kenichi, Nami. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, pretty much makes sense.
Okay, that is where he goes then. Next up is Lena Lee Lee from De Greyman, the worst named character in many a series. Lena Lee Lee. That's a very nice name for a Japanese audience. She has these amazing like boots, the innocence boots. That's her innocence weapon.
She's from Air Gear.
She basically is. If you've paid attention to us trying to explain how the Air Gear characters work, she's kind of the same. She is canonically supersonic, and in fact, when she levels up her boots to level 4 or whatever,
crystal level,
the crystal level, whatever,
she becomes super duper sonic.
Yeah, it just canonically makes her stronger and faster. And she was already supersonic, so she's faster than being faster than sound.
Right.
So, in addition to that, one of her attacks can kind of change the boot's shape into a very heavy blade. So she can deliver a supersonic kick that pierces and or slashes, there's a lot of weight behind it multiplied by the speed at which she's going.
Supersonic heavy blade boot kick. It does sound like an oh great thing.
That is a really concise, catchy name for an attack.
Yep.
All right, so there's a lot of emphasis in all of our tier list placed on speed. So I'm kind of scrolling back up our list here. And I'm going to start... Let's start at the top of high tier, because I see a few Bleach characters there, and I see Krillin from Dragon Ball. Admittedly, these are not the fastest of the fast in the Bleach universe, but they're still Bleach fast. Renji Rukia and Ishida Uryu, and Krillin is right above Ishida. Your thoughts, Drew, on relative speed and or how you think these fights might play out?
I feel like if we're talking about supersonic speed, it's probably faster than the slower end of Bleach characters, probably about even with what the higher end of Bleach characters have.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think, though, that, like, Renji and Rukia have, like, a higher level of devastative power, but I'm just not sure if it's going to, like, their best attacks are going to take slower hits, and I'm not sure if they're going to be able to hit Lina Lee.
Right. And exactly what would they do to kill her? I mean, Renji just has... He doesn't have any type of, like, area effect damaging attacks, does he?
He has the snake thing that shoots a unidirectional beam.
Right. And then Rukia does have a bit more of an area of effect attack, but she still has to actively target a patch of ground or something, right?
It's still very much a contained circular pillar.
Right, and there's no way that she would be battle-savvy enough to concentrate her attack in one place where she can calculate where a supersonic character will be in the future.
Yeah, she's just not... She's not Shikamaru.
Exactly, that's a good point. So yeah, I'm guessing that she goes above those characters. So moving her up to elite tier then, we look immediately at the duo of Jiraiya and Orochimaru. And your thoughts on that? A couple of different but similar characters.
Oh, I look first at Orochimaru, and I don't think that there's any way that a character whose main attack is cutting can kill Orochimaru. I mean, you cut him and he just spawns more snakes, but I think that's a definite matchup issue. I mean, you can't just count her out based solely on that. So I look at the Jiraiya fight, and I feel like she's got an edge there.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same. What about you?
The sense I get from Jiraiya is that he could be cut down, especially if he has to form hand seals first.
Right. We did look up the... what was the technique? It was the one where he summons the esophagus?
The mountain toad esophagus stomach thing? I don't...
That we kind of figure that might be his best course of action if he were aware even that he was going to fight a character like this with such speed. And it might. I'd just like to say a quick thank you to the Naruto Wikia contributors who are aware of the hand seals used in all these different kinds of attacks.
Yeah, we had originally thought that maybe this was just a really fast technique. But no, he has to get like 8 hand seals in, so it kind of countered him out of the fight.
Yeah, it's a good knowledge to have, you know. Good knowledge to...
In one very, very specific case.
This is the only time that has ever come in handy in a reasonably intelligent form.
Oh, right, they have the hand seals, great.
I would kind of agree, loses to Orochimaru but beats Jiraiya. So let's look one notch above at Devilman from, believe it or not, Devilman. Your thoughts on Lina Lee versus Devilman, would he even be able to apply his great strength against a target so quick?
Yeah, there's the issue of her being so much faster and the issue of her weapons being anti-demon, in a sense. So it's a counter in more ways than one.
Yeah, I tend to think that she would beat Devilman. What about you?
Yeah, I think so. I think she's just too fast and her weapons kind of are super effective.
Okay, so then of that trio, she would go above based on the 2 versus the 1. What about Hitsugaya from Bleach? He may not be necessarily too much faster than the other Bleach characters we talk about, perhaps a notch faster, but he certainly does have what Rukia doesn't in terms of ice techniques.
His real difference is the area of effect. I mean, in his pandering to fans, Kubo has gave Hitsugaya this ridiculous vast array of techniques based on his sword. And one of them is that it is snowing, and if a snowflake connects, you are frozen.
Right.
Yeah, and that's going to be pretty hard to avoid even going at supersonic speed. I don't see her getting past that large of an area of effect.
Makes sense to me. And then everything above that, we have Frederica and Ace, a couple fire characters. Konan, definitely area of effect. Is this where ultimately Lina Lee falls, is right below Hitsugaya?
I think so. We have a couple area of effect characters joined together right there, and she's not going to get past any of them.
Okay, that places Lina Lee then right below Hitsugaya, but above Devilman. And finally concluding this week with another female, Kujo Jolene, the protagonist of Series 6 of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, Stone Ocean. Her main power, her stand is called Stone Free, and it's a string-based stand. Basically, she can unravel and recollect herself. She cannot completely unravel. She can unravel to, I think it's said, about 70% of her body mass before it starts getting really dangerous for her own health. And she can't really unravel anything around her heart because that's a critical part of her organs. Once she concentrates her string fist together, the punch has about the devastation of a small but fast-moving meteor, is what the actual canon said. So I'm going to scroll back down because ultimately, I mean, as powerful as the punch might be, she's not exceptionally fast She doesn't have too much in the way of exceptional defense, because ultimately, if the string is cut, that damage does translate to her. She's certainly not invulnerable when she's in transition. It's nothing at all like a Logia. So let's start at the bottom end of mid-tier and take a look at how these characters fare in comparison. We have Ogami Rei, the big area of effect fire attacks, or supernatural fire attacks. Chad with a beam, Maroka with a black hole. Do you think that String Woman stands any chance?
That's looking pretty hopeless for her. I mean, it's almost like these characters were designed to take out String. We have a fire user, a beam user, and someone with a black hole.
Yeah, I mean, and we're not talking like Logia level scattering yourself here, just like parts of your body, and there are still weak spots.
One of these days we're going to find a Poison Bees character for Maroku. so yeah, let's take a look then at the top of fair tier. Sano from the Law of Ueki. Not the earlier Sano, but a different Sano. Sano from Law of Ueki with the power to turn towels into iron, and then later on magnetic towels. Drew, thoughts on Sano versus Jolene?
Yeah, I think Sano has boomerang cutters. I feel like, especially like as a string person, she'd be just as vulnerable to those as anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's just sort of a quick, like, cut her down and get be done with it thing for him.
Makes sense to me. What about Ranma?
I don't know that Ranma has techniques that can deal with that. I mean, it's a lot of martial arts. He would just get wrapped around by the string.
Mm-hmm.
Whole, like, Ranma has, like, a wall-breaking punch, but she has a meteor power punch, which is...
Right.
Pretty high scale.
Decidedly stronger. That would put her, if that is ultimately where we place her, above Ganta. I would imagine that she could just kind of...
warp around bullets.
Yeah, yeah, break down her body wherever the bullets were being fired. Put her above Zoro, who certainly, if he could connect with the swords, would have a decided advantage. But he's not exceptionally quick, in-universe at least. So I would get the feeling that she'd be able to kind of unravel, perhaps wrap herself around his arms, reform behind him and meteor punch, you know, something like that.
Right.
Makes sense to me. Any complaints then putting her right below Sano?
Not here.
No.
Okay, so that is where she will go, right below Sano, but above Ranma. So that concludes this portion of the Great Shonen Tier List, our ongoing ridiculous project. Keep those emails coming with requests, comments, criticism, argument, what have you. Happy to hear it, shonenbeam@gmail.com. Now it's time for the anime discussion segment, and we're going to begin with episode 12 of High School of the Dead. Drew?
Well, it is the final episode of the series. It's taken us all summer to get here, but here we are. There's an EMP strike, and we see it from two perspectives. Pretty much all the electronics in the series, except for the Humvee they have, because it was triple copper plated, are now broken down. And because of that, the zombies get through to the mansion they're staying at, and that basically sets the stage for Saya and her parents to go their separate ways. And then the gang just escapes the mansion, and that's the end of the series. So, yeah.
It was a fun ride. It wasn't amazing. It wasn't as good as it was hyped to be, but...
Yeah, well, I think we were hyping it more than, like, was reasonable, I guess. I did enjoy it as much as I enjoy other Madhouse fare. It had some great episodes, but certainly I feel like the mansion arc towards the end... This episode was perfectly solid. I really enjoyed it. Prior to this point, the mansion arc was feeling pretty stale.
Yeah, it was spending too long in one locale. It needed to move around a little more.
Well, High School of the Dead is now dead.
Seito Kai Yakuin Demo, episodes 12 and 13, the last two episodes.
Yeah, we received 13 just before we did the podcast tonight, so thanks to Aiko for that. Episode 12 was our main character's sister is getting into the school. She wouldn't have got into the school as she just drew... the symbol for three-person sex on her test paper, but...
in Scantron.
Yeah, in Scantron. But she had the pervert teacher for her interviewer.
And they had the most wonderful double entendre conversation.
Yeah, it was pretty well done. And there was also leaks and anuses during that episode, no?
Yeah, there were. It was suggested anyway. There was shock to reactions of that mention, yes.
Yes. Okay, and that moves us naturally into episode 13, in which we see basically a recap of the series, and the credits roll like 10 minutes into the episode.
And then there's more recap.
Yeah.
only recap that's different from what explicitly happened.
Yeah, we see the newspaper club girl's recap of her her plot in the series was especially well done.
Yeah, I liked that. I also liked the fact that the porno she bought for Suda was now a keychain.
Yeah, it was now a keychain, and they went back to the present time, and it actually was a keychain.
And that, just a hilarious little play on things.
And then they had subtitles at the top that were going on that was like, have we jumped to a different point in time scale? Have we messed with the continuum? And comments like that, and then it was like, no, I guess not.
And then just a little cute thing that's they're going to keep with the student council for another year.
Yeah.
So it was a nice little comfortable ending.
It was a good way to cap off the series.
Yeah.
And it was the series as a whole then?
It was funny as hell. I mean, the series was very, very funny.
It's a solid gag series. There are a lot of jokes I've seen in here that wouldn't have worked elsewhere, but the characters were good enough to carry it through.
And it has some really good voice actors.
Excellent. All right, Legend of the Legendary Heroes, episode 13.
Well, in this episode of Legend of the Legendary Kiefer is back, finally. We get to see more of her. First, there's a little bit of flashback to the Academy and obvious foreshadowing to the fact that she's going to show up. And then we see her wandering in the Kingdom of Stahl, being under assault by Gastark, and then actually meeting the King of the Country, who is a very interesting character. He has a giant sword, and it's interesting because in the new opening they had in this episode, he was wearing an eye patch, but in this episode he didn't have an eye patch, but then we found out that he has this giant sword that every time he uses it, he gets a giant beam attack, but he has to sacrifice something. And apparently this is the third time he's done it. This time we saw him sacrifice his left eye for it and do it in a pretty gutsy bluff, actually, claiming that he could do the beam attack all day to the neighboring country to get them to surrender. So that was interesting. And she seems like she's going to have a lasting relationship with that king, which sets her up for more appearances. And as that interesting of a character, I am very excited for that. The other thing of note this episode is that it seems like everybody, Miron, Kiefer, and Reiner and Ferris as well, they're all headed towards Runa, the country, and specifically Rajit, the town. So it just seems like it's doing what good adventure series do, which is tie a lot of plot threads and different characters together and get them to interact in such a way. So I am really excited about this series right now.
Excellent. Episode 12 of Nurarihyon no Mago is the continuation initially of the Yura and Muchi fight. Keikai and Yura, the Onmyoji, and Muchi, the wind whip using demon. But that the focus of that quickly shifts because ultimately Muchi is flying away. His ultimate purpose is to take out Nurarihyon, the elder Nurarihyon. He's currently at the top of a building very near to where Yura is, so he flies off after him. She's chasing him. But there is a showdown before she can reach him between Nurarihyon, the elder, and Muchi, in which we really get to see the first taste of his fear and the Nura clan's, the inner family's style of fear, where basically he's right in front of Muchi, but Muchi can't actually recognize him. He can sense the presence, but he can't actually see him whatsoever. So Nurarihyon just casually walks up to him and stabs him through the chest and kills him off. So just through that far in the episode, what did you make of that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting power to just be able to, have a character not see you because they don't want to acknowledge your existence. I don't think anything like that has really been done before.
Specifically fear-based, I can't think of an example now. What did you think of it, Drew?
Oh, I was not too impressed by it. It seems like it's an interesting one-off use for a power. I don't know about a character in the main series having this power who shows up constantly.
Okay. The episode continues on after that. There was a bit of comedy there after Muchi was defeated as Yura finds Nurarihyon and obviously is wondering, well, where's the yokai that I was chasing down? She starts patting herself on the back for doing a good job, apparently. But after the comedy, we get to see some more of the characters that have been kind of foreshadowed. You get to see them in shadows off screen a little bit. As we finally get to meet Tamazuki and Inugami, these two other yokais who seem to have it out for Rikuo. We don't have a concrete explanation of why exactly they have it out for him, but Tamazuki in particular seems to exhibit some kind of a relation to him in a way, as though we're kind of the same but opposite. And obviously they're intimidating the little group that's assembled at the time, including Kana-chan. So that is going to lead us obviously forward into the next serious plot. What do you make? I know, Clint, you read the manga as well as I do. So try to disconnect yourself a little bit from your existing knowledge of the series. What did you make of this introduction?
It's interesting, to say the least. The characters seem fairly threatening and leading us into an obvious confliction arc.
Mm-hmm.
Between their clan and the Nura clan.
Right.
I mean, to me, the one thing that was really, really good about this episode was just seeing Inugami, especially, just being really appropriately creepy in his approach to introducing himself to Yura, or Nura.
And Kana.
Yes, and Kana, especially Kana.
He licked her on the cheek. I think that means she's pregnant. All right, so yeah, good episode overall?
Yeah, for the most part.
All right, good. All right, now time for This Week in Manga, and we're going to begin this week by taking a look at Bleach 421. Color page right off the bat. We were slightly mistaken, I will admit. It wasn't all black that Ichigo is wearing. It's
black and blue.
Some black and a lot of blue fabric, which is all right, whatever. What was up with his skin color? Like, not in a racist way. It's just like, we know he's white. It was like pale and... He looked sick.
Maybe because he's not getting enough sunlight under all those clothes.
He's hiding inside. He has to brood. So we've complained many a time, especially me, about the fact that Ichigo only has one attack. He only uses Getsuga Tensho. He has exactly one attack. Now we have, like, canon reinforcement that he can only use one attack.
And then his powers are just gone forever.
So, yeah, let's just kind of summarize the chapter first. Basically, the after effect of Mugetsu from last chapter, we get to see Ichigo in this chapter, his Shinigami powers disappear completely. It kind of crumbles away. It's a visual representation of him losing his powers. And it didn't work. Aizen is still there. Aizen starts to get cocky again.
And then the Hōgyoku gets bored.
Yeah. Then Urahara Kisuke shows up, and there's something going on. There's a Kido that's affecting Aizen. And basically, he's starting to use a sealing technique, which wouldn't work on Aizen, because Aizen feels very confident that the Hōgyoku, is more than powerful enough to deal with that. But all of a sudden, he's suffering great damage, and it turns out that the Hōgyoku is displeased with him as an owner now. So he's... is detaching itself from Aizen. And the chapter sort of ends with this scene of Aizen being apparently sealed. It's kind of a multitude of crosses intertwined with one another. Not exactly sure yet if this is a conclusion to the Deicide arc, but that's what we have to go on for this chapter. My first major issue with this chapter is the convenient, oh, here's a new character to deliver an attack because the existing character in the fight wasn't cutting it, sort of plot twist.
Yeah, I mean, Bleach has been doing this for a while now. And while I certainly think it's within Urahara's character to know that the Hōgyoku would do this because he was its creator, he is the inventor of all we've seen in the series.
Right.
It did kind of seem a bit... out there.
The explanation specifically of, I put this layered Kido on you when you were at your lowest, or when you had your guard down. How does a being like that have his guard down? With not just Aizen, who was already incredibly strong, but he had the Hōgyoku, which was like a sentient thing.
He was all-powerful after the Kido was placed. Why was the Kido not just deleted or something?
Exactly. The thing I actually kind of did like the writing choices of this chapter, because it sort of like boils down to the Hōgyoku got bored. And I think it's a good way to write a broken character. If it's dependent on an item, they have to be keeping the item entertained in some way. I personally felt that the chapter would have been like perfectly satisfying to me if not for that bit of Kido, just because Aizen is failing to compete with Ichigo, then like the Hōgyoku loses its trust in him and abandons him.
I would have found that far more interesting if it was not prompted by a particular event that did not involve our protagonist. Why is our protagonist not able to do anything?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want Ichigo to just be like a perfect character that wipes everyone off the map. Then it would get kind of boring near the end.
Bleach would get boring, yes.
But at the same time, he can't do anything. He needs some power, doesn't he?
He needs to be able to do something at least. Beat one enemy once in a while that, you know, the Hogyoku didn't decide you should beat.
He got a major, major power-up that we've never even really seen. I guess you could call the previous incarnations of the Shikai and Bankai, the transition, going from the large Zanpakuto to a smaller one, you could call that a kind of hint that, okay, now it's going even smaller to the point where it doesn't even really tangibly exist anymore. But we haven't really had a concrete idea that this was forthcoming. A really major power-up, a huge-scale attack, and it was all for naught.
Yeah.
Yeah, that does kind of get me. Human? Like, what even was Mugetsu? I personally still don't understand even that part. It was just an exceptionally large type of attack. I'm not sure how that gels with him having been powerful enough to defeat Aizen. But again, I do like the end result of the writing choice, which is that like the Hogyoku gets bored easily.
Didn't you see it coming?
I've seen it done before in that way. I just thought it was... That part was interesting to read and made sense to me for, like, to write the Hogyoku as broken as it is without having to actually explicitly change what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. And then there is another major, major point
the
of
major
note.
Point, yeah, the
is
other one.
The Spirit King. Now, there's a couple different facets to this. First of all is just the existence of the Spirit King, which is that there's this being that holds Soul Society together. He's kind of the balancing linchpin or what have you. We don't know too much at this point. But apparently whatever this was is what Aizen was going against, at least if I'm understanding the chapter correctly, whereas Kisuke is kind of either turning a blind eye or just okay with it because he wants to maintain the balance of things and or not get involved.
Yeah, I would call it tolerant of it.
Yeah, right. Like, I mean, so long as you're not dying, everything's fine.
This seems as though this is going to be either our next antagonist or the catalyst for ongoing story right after this. We don't exactly know the nature of the Spirit King, but it could be the bad guy or it could be what leads us to the bad guy.
It seems to me like the Spirit King is just going to be the next enemy in this kind of structure of, you know, fight the established order that we saw from Soul Society.
Now, the next problem that I have with this is Aizen. And the way that it seems as though there are hints now that he's going to be painted as, you know, the tragic anti-hero, kind of, where he was committing all these evil acts, but in a way he's just misunderstood because he was fighting against a greater injustice all along.
That to me, first of all, they just did that a couple chapters ago and it felt lame then.
Yes.
For a lesser villain.
Yes. It's not solidified that that is the plot arc or plot direction that we'll be going in, but it certainly seems as though.
Talking about seeing the same twist, in that twist, we saw a character who Rangiku had been wronged by Aizen.
Yeah.
Which serves really no purpose in this plot of take down the Spirit King. He was just being an asshole.
Exactly. If Kubo is going to attempt to glorify any of Aizen's actions at this point, well,
why?
It's not as though I can say, oh, and suddenly I lose faith in Kubo. But, you know, I mean, that's just yet another slap in the face because he's committed far too much blatant evil. It's not just that he was misunderstood. There's no possible way that you could claim that Aizen was misunderstood. He was just an asshole.
He
was doing it for love.
making Hitsugaya stab Hinamori. That was completely...
Oh, yeah. That's all part of his greater plan of good.
Greater good. Yeah.
Oh, my. All right, so my final verdict on this Bleach chapter is that it's a huge step backwards from the previous chapter. What about you, Clint?
I kind of thought that it kind of kept up with the previous chapter, which is not to say that it is good or that chapter was good.
And you, Drew?
Yeah, I felt like this chapter, compared to the previous chapter, this felt like a competent writing choice. I still did not enjoy it particularly.
Okay. Naruto, chapter 511. First of all, jump cover, reminding us it's been 11 years of Naruto. Doesn't really feel like it.
That's crazy, yeah.
Yeah,
just surprised. I had a Facebook friend who said, Naruto, 11 years, where has my youth gone? but yeah, Naruto 511 is almost entirely a flashback. The setup begins with you get to see Madara actually reclaiming the Rinnegan, but most of this chapter is flashback of the Amegakure trio of Yahiko, Nagato, and Konan. And you see them, first of all, having trained under Jiraiya in toad outfits. Why were they wearing toad suits?
Because
Jiraiya's the toad sage.
Of course.
Besides, he had to have them wearing it appropriately so he could explain those placards.
Yeah.
that was very necessary.
So the whole placard idea, Kishimoto creates this little piece of imagery in this chapter. And then later on in the chapter, we get to see, we see Jiraiya leaving the trio, obviously permanently. And so you get to see the close-up shot of his placard remaining on the side that indicates that he's still out. You have the scene where Nagato is out, and you see Yahiko and Konan in the room together where Konan is kind of bandaging up Yahiko. And we have the placards behind them showing that only Nagato is out and they're leaning in for a kiss together. There's a lot of silent storytelling in this chapter that was really made possible by the little, almost throwaway piece of imagery that he created at first, but it ended up providing a launching pad for so much more in this chapter. I have to say I was pretty impressed. I've been impressed with his art for a long time, but this wasn't just art in the sense of he can draw well. This was art in the sense of great design and great forethought with relation to the story.
Yeah, he was using an element of the drawing to great effect.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a great concept to make a chapter out of. Certainly, if you're going to make a chapter about Yahiko and Nagato Konan, like, now is the time. It's the last time when any of them will be relevant or, like, have recently been alive.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think that the imagery development with the plaque was particularly well done and just very a joy to read.
Absolutely. And then finally, the end of this chapter shows the remaining members of Akatsuki, if you can still call them that, really. It's Madara and Zetsu, and we see Kabuto is there, who's not at all a member of them, but he has a shaky alliance at best, I suppose. And we see Madara's new mask, which is another piece of imagery showing that he has now both the Sharingan and the Rinnegan. I think, first of all, just the new mask itself, a really appropriately menacing new mask.
Yeah, it definitely suits him, and I think it's more than anything meant to show, like, the character growth in him, like he's gotten another power now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do like where they're going with that. It's an increasingly alien mask compared to his last one.
Yeah.
And I think that corresponds to sort of the nature of Madara as a character.
Izanagi, yeah.
Yeah.
No kidding. Zetsu has shown that they have retrieved the scroll that was Kisame's last act on this planet. He managed to get the information to his intended target, so things are looking up for the Akatsuki-Kabuto alliance. I'm still placing a lot of hope in Kabuto and the role that he's going to play. Do you at all share my opinion?
Yeah, he's definitely the most menacing villain we have at the moment. Mm. Certainly more menacing than either Sasuke or Madara.
Madara is obviously shown to be more powerful so far. We have no real concept of Kabuto's power yet, but Kabuto, I feel personality-wise, is far more legitimate as a villain. What are your thoughts?
I feel like Kabuto can be an entertaining character to watch, but there's no way he's a main villain of even this arc.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that perhaps an arc following this, he could have a time to shine, or do you think that he won't feature
it'll depend
that
on the development of this arc, but he just doesn't feel like main villain material to me.
Okay. We had a comment on this, personally, from TD, who did not like the idea of another flashback, but it was nice to see Jiraiya again. Just overall, I mean, the chapter itself was nice, but do you agree with the concept of placing a flashback here?
Yeah, I kind of do, actually. I just thought it was a fitting place. I mean, we talked about how much we liked Konan. I kind of think she did deserve some kind of closure to her death, and certainly the others did, too. They were all fairly fleshed out characters for how little we had seen them. And mm-hmm. I thought the flashback was very well done.
What about you, Drew?
To me, it doesn't fit on paper, but it was so well executed that it deserves to be in there as a chapter.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the feeling that I have, is that I really do want to get on with the story, but this is a chapter that deserved to be shown. All right. So, an enjoyable chapter, despite perhaps a couple reservations about its placement. Overall, a very enjoyable chapter. Bakuman, chapter 102, which continues to focus on this development that is taking place between Mashiro and Takagi, and now including Shiratori and all
of
this.
Yeah, awkward is kind of the word for what is going on. It's how the characters kind of feel. It's how we're kind of feeling as readers.
Yeah.
Certainly, like, all the expressions that Mashiro is pulling are...
Yeah, awkward is one word you could use to describe those. Comedic is another. Like the bug-eyed look on him at times.
Yeah.
But certainly, he is not responding brilliantly to this.
Yeah, I think Kaya kind of, in true Kaya style, hit the nail on the head.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about how Mashiro wouldn't say anything that he had a problem with it because he can't. He's not that type of person.
Although, to be fair, it's not as though Mashiro is necessarily 100% against this. I mean, we shouldn't be looking at it from that point of view. I'm sure there is an aspect to his character that genuinely is happy to see Takagi succeeding.
Right.
But if that were to take away from their relationship, I don't think that Mashiro has, maybe not the maturity, maybe that's not the right word. I don't think he's quite equipped to handle that yet. And especially with what we saw on the last page there of just the actual caption revealing that, yes, there is a growing development distancing between the two, a rift of some kind. The relationship and the way that it plays out from now on is going to be really, really interesting to follow. What do you make that there was a lot of focus on Shiratori, very specifically. It wasn't just the fact that he's doing a story with Takagi now. There was also a lot of focus on his own personal life and the trouble that he's going through with his family. Do you enjoy the plot that was set up, and do you feel that this was the right time to show it?
I think this is probably the good time to develop his character. Maybe a little bit earlier than like they're actually starting the manga would have been good too.
Right.
But it's well done. His plot with his family is well done. It's not my favorite kind of character archetype. He's kind of the meek character who's trying to break out into his own. I don't really identify with it, but it is well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, it really is adding to the story because the focus on the changing relationship between the members of Ashirogi is going to be interesting to look at. That in and of itself is going to be the really interesting focus of all of this. I'm not so sure that I want to focus on that and so much to do with Shiratori at the same time. I feel that we could potentially get into some pacing issues with that. Do you share those worries at all?
Yeah, it could be a bit much trying to carry out both of those very serious plots. Both of them are quite serious, and trying to do them both at once might not do justice to both.
What did you think about Azuki kind of intentionally being left out of all of this?
Yeah, I don't know. We haven't really got to hear what she's going to weigh in like on the current situation. She doesn't know that there isn't going to be an anime, and in fact, if Kaya's been talking to her, she's sure there's going to be an anime, and she's going to be the voice actress.
All right, so overall then, your thoughts on the chapter?
I kind of have mixed feelings on it. I mean, it felt weird, but it was still well done with the quality Bakuman has.
Yeah, I'm feeling really awkward, which I guess is how I'm supposed to feel about all these developments, but I'm not so sure it's in an intentional sort of way. I think it's just I'm feeling even more awkward than I'm supposed to because I just don't know if I like where this is going.
Yeah.
Fairy Tale, chapter 202. Could you briefly give us a synopsis of that chapter, Joe?
Well, continuing on from last chapter where we saw that they're going to have the S-class exam, we see everybody is told that they can have one partner and that the S-class mages, Erza, Mira, and Gildarts will all be serving as like guards or or at least like obstacles, I guess the best word would be for it, on the S-class exam, whatever it is. And they say that they have 1 week to do it, but that seems just mostly an excuse for a short time skip. And they do actually, interestingly enough, they mentioned that if Natsu were an S-class mage, he might be able to find Igneel.
Yeah.
So that's fairly explicitly hinting at what we wanted out of the S-class exam already.
Absolutely.
Now, granted, there's a lot of territory between here and there, but that's an optimistic sign. And then we see all the different pairings. Natsu partners with Happy. Loke partners with Gray, which that one I liked. Luvia and Lissana for some reason.
Right.
Which, like, I feel like that was a little bit of wasted opportunity there, but whatever. Elfman and Evergreen, which is an odd one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Really fun.
And that's like polar opposites. It feels like they're going to be fighting halfway through.
Right.
And then we see Levy partnering up with Gajil again.
Yeah.
It'll work out. I'm sure it'll work out. That's just very interesting chemistry in two pairings in a row.
Right.
And then, oddly enough, we see Mest pairing up with Charles later on.
Which, yeah.
For whatever reason, like, that struck me by surprise. And I don't know how to feel about that, really.
Not certain either. Yeah, it's just it really did catch me by surprise also.
Yeah, that's out of the blue. And then we're treated to a little scene at the end where, like, Lucia and Kana, they go back to her apartment and Kana tells her backstory.
Not to us.
But yeah.
Jerk.
Well, that's true. We did not get to see what the actual backstory was, but I feel like it wouldn't have fit properly into those five pages, and Lucy's reaction shot to it, that was... I felt that was pretty well done.
Mm-hmm.
Just the whole reaction and the trembling afterwards.
Right.
And then they're partnering up, and we are at the port where they're about to shift off to the S-Class exam.
Yeah.
So.
It's still a setup chapter, but an interesting one with plenty of development. I have to say I'm overall happy with it. I'm not happy with happy. I just think it's rather unimaginative. I mean, that's what it should be for Natsu. That's the easy way out for Natsu to just pick happy again. And I guess maybe it would feel wrong if he wasn't in a way, but it's just like you said with Elfman and Evergreen, like that is what's so cool about these types of scenarios, just shocking picks, and then everything that's going to follow, like following the chemistry between those two. Natsu and Happy is just more Natsu and Happy.
I mean, like, cat companions don't strike me as that interesting, especially when Gazeel was available.
Yeah.
Yeah. Double Dragon.
That would have been...
Yeah.
All the way across the suck.
Jimmy and Bimmy. Jimmy and Bimmy. A typo in a Nintendo game. But most of the other pairings were pretty good, I'd have to say.
I think it was pretty well set up, and good for a build-up chapter. Again, I am as excited as I've been about Fairy Tail for a while, certainly since we've started podcasting about it.
Illuvia is, I think, who I'm going to be focusing on the most in all of this. She's just... we're getting some response on the website, too, about it. We're not the only ones who like Illuvia. It seems that she's a really likable character.
Yeah, which is nice. Again, she is a character who brings a lot of potential to the series. And, like, for the characters of Fairy Tail, probably one of... It's not a totally original premise, but one of the more, like, originally done premises for character setups.
We have a question, actually, on the site from last week's Beamcast regarding the last week we covered chapters 200 and 201. This is from Samuel, who asks us, when Charlotte was looking at that prediction with, the unfortunate event that seems that it will be occurring, and Natsu was kind of crying, sort of. You know, he was obviously devastated over something that had happened, and we saw a hand. Samuel was wondering if we can even venture any guesses as to who it was that would have been offed.
Well, to me, it feels like it could be Elfman. That would be a real punch to the gut after the siblings get back together.
Yeah.
Or it would have to be someone, not just like a comrade, but somebody reasonably close to, for Natsu to be crying like that. So it could be Elfman. It could be Happy. I don't see a lot of other potential characters it could be.
I don't really think it could be Happy. I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to that. I think it would be a very, very bold choice. But I just don't see it happening. What about Lissana?
True. Like, I feel... Lissana, it could be. Lissana is just way too obvious, though, I feel. I feel like that's the choice you just absolutely cannot pick. As far as, like, if you're going to take the time to bring a character back, don't just offer in the next arc. That's why I feel like Elfman is a possibility, because comradeship with Natsu, and like he is one of that three group of siblings that just got back together.
Yeah, I agree with you. That is the one that shouldn't be picked for obvious reasons, because it's too easy, but it is Hiro Mashima we're talking about.
That is
groundbreaking. So,
but I guess those three are the main candidates.
Yeah, thank you very much for the comment, Samuel. Appreciate your feedback. That was not all you posted about, I'm aware, but that's the most relevant thing for this moment. I appreciate your feedback. There's not too much else to discuss from this chapter. I thought it was really nice. I have to agree with you, though, that I'm not hugely excited necessarily, but this is easily the most promising that I felt the series has been for at least 50 chapters.
Yeah, that's a fair statement.
Quite some time. All right, moving on then. Hayate no Gotoku, chapter 289, which is focusing further on the meeting at Ashibashi-sensei's place for Nagi to submit her manga. A lot of comedy in this one regarding manga and the lifestyle of the mangaka.
Yeah, some really good comedy. Quite a few in-jokes, I think, made by the manga author.
The focus, before we get to the little serious note at the end, just all the focus on what it's like to be a mangaka, what it means to be a mangaka. I can do the impossible because I'm a mangaka, but it's all this ridiculous, over-the-top type of stuff. That was very funny.
Hayate's revival drink.
Yeah, I wish I had the list of ingredients on hand. That would wake you up.
That would quite do quite well.
Yeah, yeah, that would certainly get you off the couch.
Purple drink.
It's like Inui's juice.
Oh. No, wait, Jamarcus Russell had that, so it couldn't have been good.
Not enough Prince of Tennis fandom, damn it. But really, I think the thing to take away most from this chapter, as funny as the rest of it was, and it truly was funny, the sense of realization from Nagi on the last page, when this Ashibashi-sensei, you see him barely get up. He's 4 days past his deadline. You see him barely get up, and he's rushing to get this out the door because he has to either turn it in now or he's going to be canned. And he's just, as he's doing all of this as hurriedly as possible, Nagi looks it over and sees true quality from a true professional mangaka, and she realizes, she says to herself, just scribbles, and it's originally misinterpreted as, oh yeah, I know, this is all that we can do, but we're hurrying as fast as you can, and she says, no, what I've been doing is just scribbles. I can't believe that I wanted to aspire to this. I'm not even in the same league. For where the series has been in the past several chapters, which has been focusing almost entirely on pure comedy, that was a really poignant and sort of touching moment for the ongoing maturity of this little spoiled brat, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, it's really her realization that she has not been doing as well as she thought she was. I mean, she kind of thought that her manga was good. She thought the only difference between hers and, like, a running manga was that she was doing manuscripts. And then she kind of realizes that what she's doing isn't really a manuscript. It's just, it's not that good.
Yeah. I was very impressed with that. Now, who's to say that it's going to carry over into anything? Certainly it's going to carry over a little bit. It has to, just for the sake of wrapping up that little part of the storyline.
Right.
I don't get the feeling that it's going to stay focused on this for too long, do you?
No, I don't think her becoming a mangaka is like a major plot of the series right now. I think we're trying to... We're focusing mainly on the plot to find out what's going on with firing bottle rockets. Yeah. And we're also focusing on getting back into the mansion.
Yeah, I'm ready for that to happen, but this has been a rather enjoyable diversion, I'd have to say.
Yeah, it's been pretty good for the most part. Some really good comedy in that the moment at the end of this chapter.
Yep. Kakashi, chapters 321 and 322 were released this week. What happened in them, Drew?
Well, in the first chapter we see sort of the meeting where not a whole lot of strategy is discussed, but people just sort of get acquainted with one another. And Masamori meets up with a mustache guy. We see an interesting little subtle bit of depth from him. He apparently married into his wife's family and took her name, which is, again, an interesting, like, not unexpected cultural note for, like, the type of series Kakashi is. But
right.
Just to see a character be humbled in such a way is, it's a really good, gives a really good sense of, like, just how this character has sort of been dragged along into it. He's not as enthusiastic about it, but he is loyal to the cause, in a sense.
It was nice. The focus wasn't too long on that, but it was just enough, really.
Yeah.
We wouldn't want too much exposition on this kind of a character
right now.
Necessary
drop in the bucket.
Yeah, but I liked it.
And then we see a scene between Masa and the founder, and he just sort of, Masa gets words of encouragement after, like, having worked for so long. He just gets these words from the founder, which are not really that meaningful, just to the effect of, like, don't struggle too hard. The world will wrap itself around you if you've been working for a long time and you're getting payoff from that. So
right.
Just stay focused towards the end. The end is almost here.
Kind of, I'm not too sure what to make of that conversation. I still have a very hard time putting my finger on whether I like or dislike or just don't really have an opinion either way on the relationship between Masamori and the founder. I'm not certain about that.
I don't feel like it's been strongly developed enough yet. I feel like it'll need to be more strongly developed in the action leading up to it, because right now we've just had a bunch of more vague conversations, but not horrible conversations.
Oh, certainly not.
Not as developed as one would like. And then the meat of both of these two chapters really is Tokine makes an appearance again, which has been long overdue, but is very welcome at this point.
Yes. Very pleased with that.
His dad, he's on the phone. So Yoshimori is on the phone with his dad, and then his dad just hands the phone over to Tokine, and they start talking. And just, first of all, the atmosphere, the depiction of that scene was incredible. It just blew me away. And we also get to hear that Tokine's training is almost done. She's almost ready to go for, like, the major final battle. That's another big setup. And we get to see the aftermath of this phone call, which is that Yoshimori just can't concentrate on his work.
Yeah, that struck me. I mean, he's not exactly been like the picture of cool, but he's been pretty well composed for most of this. And this is not a series where characters go off, for the most part, where characters go off on like rash, bold, reactionary motions or anything like that. I mean, everything for the most part is fairly well deliberate, fairly well planned. So seeing like a little, is, you know, frankly self-admitted, obviously, but seeing a little outburst of emotion like that, I think the fact that these characters have been so contained for so long means that this moment had that much more impact.
Yeah, I think this is something that really stands out through his subtlety, and certainly just the little touch of him having blown his concentration when he's working thanks to that phone call.
Right.
It fits with the scene so well. And then Tokune's visit, we see a bit more of the role she's going to play in the upcoming things, and she's apparently going to play the role of a diplomat. She's going to negotiate the current landlord off her land, which is appropriate with what she's been trying to do over time. She's been trying to like sort of leverage her powers diplomatically where she can,
right,
concentrate and focus more, whereas Yoshimori is sort of a broad strokes person.
That really makes perfect sense, honestly, because for a diplomat sort of character does need to have a requisite amount of power to back up whatever it is that she brings to the table in her offer. And she certainly is powerful. She's just not powerful enough to be one of the frontline fighters, per se.
Yeah.
I think that this role would suit her rather well.
Yeah, I think it does fit her well. I think it'll be interesting to see how it fits in the context of the greater fight between the Urukai and the newly formed council.
Absolutely.
But I believe they can make it work. And then the little scene at the end where Yoshimori and she, like, they acknowledge they both have worries, but then just embrace each other.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that was what really sealed this stretch of chapters. It's just incredibly incredible, like, payoff of all the emotional development we've had.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming to get that kind of a display of emotion between the two characters.
Yeah, I have been waiting for it, and I'm completely satisfied with the results.
Yeah, and I, you know, by no means am I like one of the, you know, shipping type of readers. I'm not looking for romance where it isn't. So I wasn't exactly rooting for this one way or the other, but it fits, first of all. That's the most important thing. It fits with the characters. It's not at all out of place, and it was done in an elegant and tasteful way. Really strongly approve of the way that this has all been handled.
Yeah, it's not even getting into strong romance yet. It's just sort of them growing closer by another level, which,
right,
is, again, just fits with the series is the best way to say it.
Yeah, really, really good stretch of chapters there, and very interested in seeing what's coming up next. Arago, chapter 36, which is the conclusion of the little werewolf mini arc, where we last left off, Arago was fighting the werewolf in a duel. It was a chain match.
Chain boxing.
In the middle of a soccer field, naturally. That is the proper home for such duels, of course. And they just continued fighting, and the werewolf obviously had the strength advantage, and he was beginning to overpower Arago, and he positions himself for a big finishing sort of strike, which Arago is, thanks to his training, not able to entirely to avoid, but he's able to block with his arm. And then we see a little bit of a revelation in the evolution of the Brionok power, where he's able to regenerate that arm. Not entirely within this fight, but
from bone.
From bone, and comparatively rather quickly to what we had seen before.
Yeah, it's like 5 minutes to recover from what is like the most serious type of flesh wound you could really have.
Yeah, and still classify it as such, yes. So ultimately, Arago is able then to gain the upper hand, and he wins the fight and removes the pelt, and interestingly, it wasn't a character under the pelt that is necessarily going to serve any kind of a major role. It was just some old guy.
Yeah,
and I guess seems the pelt kind of chose him
for like reasons that I guess he had. Maybe he had like a right age body or something.
Could be.
I mean, I think that's okay for like, again, having experience with Shonen Sunday Ghost series. Like, you do have a lot of one off villains. I think this arc was well enough to, like the one Naruto chapter this week, this mm-hmm. arc itself was well enough done to carry it within the context of a larger plot, regardless of whether or not it's actually that relevant.
Right. Again, as we've mentioned before, our main worry at the beginning of this arc was whether this would be enough to carry the series this early on, when really the bulk of the driving force in this series has been Patchman, who is an excellent villain. When we initially thought he could be related to Patchman, we were very interested. When we learned of the alternate creation myth of the werewolf that was being used, we were extremely interested. Now, this is kind of just completely wrapped it up, you know, because the pelt wasn't destroyed. It was shipped off to a museum, correct?
Yeah.
So this is wrapped it up. It's not, as far as we know now, in any way related to Patchman. And it was sort of an abrupt ending to the arc. So ultimately then, with it being such an abrupt ending and with it not at all being related to Patchman, I have to agree with you that it was a story worth telling, as with the Naruto chapter this week. I guess I'm a little bit disappointed in the way it wrapped up, because while I still feel that it stood on its own as a good short arc, I feel that there was a bit of a missed opportunity, I guess, for a more interesting conclusion to the arc.
As far as the werewolf being like an actual character, I can understand that. I kind of like it being a character with no dialogue. That to me is what really seals up this arc as a good arc, the fact that the werewolf was just sort of a beast to the end, and that Argo showed him respect, gave him sort of like a beast, the equivalent of a zoo in the end.
Right.
And like, that was actually the concept that, like, in addition to the alternate legend werewolf thing, which was good,
mm-hmm.
I like the fact that it wasn't, like, a villain with, like, stereotypical laments. It was just a beast looking for meat.
Yeah, I can see that as well. So ultimately, then, we're now kind of back to square one. We have the world at our disposal here. Who knows what's coming up next, which that I'm fine with, because mm-hmm. there's so much.
There's three horsemen left over, just, like, even from the villains we know.
Yeah, there are so many different directions that our eye could go right now. Yeah, I have to say, a tiny bit let down by the ending of this mini arc, but still, this series is definitely hugely worth a read. Very, very enjoyable week to week. Toriko, Chapter 111, which focuses on Toriko's entry into the gourmet world, which we first find out just exactly how the gourmet world is regarded by the human world through a series of flashbacks to a reporter's report on what the gourmet world is like after it had been glorified as this heaven of amazing ingredients and everything.
Yeah, it's a death blender.
Yeah, it's a pretty horrible place, actually, so says the reporter.
The easiest way to get in is to jump off a cliff.
Yeah.
And be shot at by a dinosaur with a rocket nose.
So that's what we see, as you might guess. We see Toriko go to the what is apparently legitimately the easiest of the available entry points, because the other two are, one of them is blocked off by a wall of cyclones, and another is sea-based entry point, which is blocked off by like a ring of poison in the water, which, by the way, Coco?
We were set up for that.
Yeah.
They had talked about the poison tides before.
Yeah. So Coco is probably going
to... Toriko takes the cliff, and Sonny, who knows, if he learns how to fly with that hair or something.
Flap the hair? Oh, man. I guess he could, technically. That would be
why
weird.
Not?
Fabio can nearly do it.
I don't know if that would be too beautiful, and certainly if it's not, then he wouldn't do it, but who knows? Interesting idea. But anyway, Toriko opts for the land-based route, and it takes him to a cliff, which he just throws himself off. And as he's plummeting hundreds of kilometers, he first is blasted by a huge gust of wind, and it turns out to be the exhalation from the nose of a dinosaur that it can exhale.
Aiming at him from, like, miles and miles away.
Yeah.
Yep. Gourmet so security.
Yeah. That was unusual.
That actually kind of reminded me of a scene from, like, Beat the Vandal Buster, because one of the weapons the main character has is a gun that breathes, essentially, shoots out bullets of compressed air.
I'm guessing
it's shaped very like that.
I'm guessing that it's not every day something reminds you of Beat the Vandal Buster with weapons like that.
Well, whenever something goes on hold in Japan right before a major boss fight, that will also remind me of Beat the Vandal Buster.
But yeah, there's that the dinosaur, which was an interesting writing choice. Again, just this world is so creative. And then he continues to plummet. He's almost been beaten in midair, practically, because he's been blown back into these cliffs, and you see his clothes be torn up, and he's spewing out blood. So he's barely... You can't even really call him as having entered the gourmet world at this point, and he's almost down. But he continues falling, and he plummets all the way down to finally land after who knows how long he fell. And then he's being approached by what looks like a giant pseudo tiger with horns and three mouths.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like a Cerberus tiger or something.
I mean, he's going to have to survive that somehow, but
yeah. So this is the last of what we can call a setup chapter, really. This is setup and the beginning of the actual arc. Certainly just the transition into the gourmet world, the falling from the cliff, the nose breathing dinosaur thing. That was all very well and good. I found that rather interesting.
Yeah.
And now that he's actually in, I mean, does he stand a chance at all, or is he going to have to be rescued by the other person who was coming in?
He's going to have to be rescued, and I don't know who it'll be. Could be Zebra, could be Knocking Master Gero, who I certainly don't think we've seen the last of.
I don't think
we've seen the last of Gero. It feels a lot like Zebra at this point.
It's someone famous. That's all we really know about whoever it is. Is someone famous wants to come in. And Zebra certainly would be famous. I can't really think of too many other characters that it would be. It's certainly not Ichiryu, because I don't think he's even condoning him going.
Yeah.
It's obviously not anyone in Toriko's group, because what business would they have? And they probably wouldn't be famous. So, yeah, that's... Zebra would be interesting. I agree with Clinton in saying that we haven't seen the last of Gero. I just don't think this is the place for him to reappear. Zebra, I think... It's about time to get to him anyway. I really want to see who the hell this guy is.
Last of the four kings.
Yeah.
He leaves a lot of scars on you. That's all we know.
Excited about that going forward. Gamoron, chapter 63, which initially looks like it's going to be the start of a fight between Gamma and Ranmaru, but that fight turns out not to be too much of a fight.
He kind of just pins Gamma to the wall. And Gamma says it's like being up against, like, a concrete block. He can't move.
Yeah, he has no real chance in that fight, if you even want to call it that, whatsoever. He's completely overmatched. Which I have to say, I mean, you know, yes, granted, Gamma is weakened from having already fought once, but clearly he is still overmatched. I have to say I'm a little bit surprised at just how overmatched he is. Specifically because it's Ranmaru. I'm kind of surprised that he is the character that is that much stronger. There are many, many characters that I wouldn't have been too surprised about. I'm just a little bit surprised. I didn't think this much was going to come out on his character. Am I alone in that?
I don't know. I kind of expected big things from seeing as he is like an emissary of Jinsuke.
Mm-hmm. Now, meanwhile, Gamma had split off from Zenmaru, who was carrying Naoyoshi, trying to get away. Zenmaru runs into his older brother, who is apparently extremely powerful just from looking at him, you can tell.
And the way he squints like Gein.
That is not an indicator of quality, thank you. he's basically showing down with his brother, and his brother is just saying, you know, he reveals that Jinsuke is behind everything. Everything is all according to Jinsuke's plan. The entire Grand Tournament of Unabara is a creation of Jinsuke. The fact that Gamma and his entire troop met Naoyoshi-sama is all thanks to Jinsuke. I mean, all of this is a complete constructed scenario. Zenmaru's brother basically says, hand him right over because this is all fabricated anyway. And you wouldn't want to disobey me again, little brother. You don't want a repeat of what happened 5 years ago, alluding to something which we don't
know. Showed a bunch of dead bodies, yeah.
In Gamoron. Dead bodies. I don't understand this.
Tiny bit out of place.
But after that, we get to see some characters that we don't exactly know. And finally, how many chapters is this? 63 chapters in, we get to meet Jinsuke.
You know, better pacing than Inuyasha. I don't think we saw Naraku this early.
I think at that point it still had better villains than that.
I can't. That is the worst. That is the most backhanded compliment you could say about anything. Gamoron, it's better paced than Inuyasha. Oh, thank you, Clint. We get to meet Jinsuke, who has a follower, an underling who looks like Two-Face. Yeah. And we don't really know too much. It's just kind of like everything is going well. Your plans are in motion. It's kind of just like a status update for him. We don't actually see much in the way of an event happening. It's
mainly introducing Jinsuke, I think.
Right. That is the big shocking moment of the chapter. And he actually looks like Gamma.
Yeah, they did a good job. I think they're both supposed to have white, like, grayish hair.
Right.
And they both do. And his face is built similarly to Gamma's, if Gamma was, like, a couple muscle pounds heavier,
right.
Older.
Yeah, I'd say you're a really good job with the design there. I mean, he also looks like Gamma in the sense that he looks a bit carefree. Not necessarily in terms of, like, a happy-go-lucky personality, just like a aimless, meandering sort of, you know, I'll go where the wind takes me and kill everything there.
Kill everything there. With, you know, Carefree Wonder, Jinsuke the Thousand Man Slayer.
Yeah.
Yes.
But that's the very stupid way of putting my original thought, but do you share my feeling that he doesn't just look in terms of, like, facial features the same, but he seems to have the same sort of personality?
Yeah, yeah, I definitely get what you're saying. He does seem that way, like the carefree kind of attitude. That right. Just like, I don't really mind whatever's going on.
Yeah, carefree in the sense that he can brush anything off because he's that far above it. Not carefree in the sense of skipping around.
Right. No sunflowers.
Yes. All right, The World God Only Knows, chapters 113 and 114 to catch up on here. What happened in these chapters, please, Drew?
Well, first thing we saw is just a little bit of the end of the doll story and a whole lot of narrative boxes, speech bubbles type things.
Yeah.
As we were heading towards a resolution of the story, which, as I predicted earlier, it's actually a guaranteed fail route. The girl was a devil all along. Or at least a devil ally.
Yeah, that was an interesting revelation, plus who she was working for or with. I'm not sure.
She over working top with of the teacher, yeah. I think.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Which, to me, that was interesting. It's certainly, like, that along with the narrative bubbles sort of sealed that it was a fail route, and it was, I think, like, in retrospect, this was a good arc for that.
Yeah, it really adds a lot in this. I mean, that's the first one we've had, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Just an outright fail without chance for recovery later on.
Right.
Uh-huh. It's always important that the main character suffers some kind of setback at some point in whatever activity he regularly does. So this obviously fulfills that requirement for Kama. And also the fact that it sets us up for a very interesting storyline involving that teacher, who's yeah. already been shown in the background to be a powerful and interesting character.
She captured the huge demon that resulted from the giant girl.
Right.
And I think it's kind of clear now that there's, like, a good elite group of demons that are working to capture with, like, the new hell.
Yeah.
And then there is, like, an agent of the old hell trying to bring that back there at the same time, that light-haired girl that we see going around everywhere doing lots of suspicious things.
Oh, right.
To me, that light-haired girl does hold potential because it sets up, despite, with all this war between devils, it sets up a very interesting way for Kama to be useful. If she's actually possessed by a spirit.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Then 114 shifts the focus away from that and onto Kanon, correct?
Yep, the idol character, and she has a goddess, very simply put. Yeah.
Yeah, well, they just came right out. There was no mystery to be found with it. They just showed us that she has a goddess.
And
her goddess is quite a bit different than Diana.
It's the clumsy girl goddess.
It's Athena.
She's, like, really good at singing and good at nothing else.
Athena, who is making a cameo appearance from Saint Seiya, of course. Same exact character, obviously. Yeah, a little bit surprising, just the fact that they were just so forthright. Oh, yep, she has a goddess. There she is.
Yep, yep. They just showed it. But
I mean, I'm totally good with that. Fast plot advancement won't hurt this, and then it changes the festival arc away from being just Kama has to find the girl into Kama has to somehow make her reveal herself, because we also saw in chapter 114 that she's pushing herself away from Kama.
Yeah, right. she doesn't think that he likes her,
mm-hmm.
because he assumed that she forgot everything about their kiss, which she didn't because she has a goddess.
Right. Or, well, she did forget but then got back memories,
right.
Correct? Yeah, so, yeah, that is an interesting dynamic, specifically with regard to the festival.
I think it's going to... We're in for a classic kind of misunderstandings and characters going around in circles. It's going to be a little bit frustrating because it's supposed to be
right.
until they finally figure out everything that's going on.
probably some kind of, like, stumbling mistake will lead the two of them together, and then they'll have their reconciliation moment.
On the other hand, telling this story from two perspectives opens up angles of its own, at
least. I definitely liked seeing the kind of, like, from Cannon's perspective, the entire chapter was Cannon's daily life. It was well done.
Yeah, I thought a really good stretch of a couple chapters there. The fail route was the right choice to take, I think. And then this sets up for some very, very interesting plot going forward. Maho Sensei Negima, chapter 303.
So we're back with the group sneaking around trying to rescue the real Asuna. And they're walking through a hallway, and Fate walks by. And Kotaro thinks for a long time about just taking a swipe at him, trying to cut off his head, and gets a vision that would happen to him if he tried it.
Right.
Thinks better of it. Can't stops himself. He says he can't attack Fate. There's something stopping him. And I think it's kind of trying to tell us that there's like a scale for this, like, because Kotaro mentions it himself. Negi, you're really going to take on this guy. I think we're being set up to know that this is going to be a fight of epic proportions.
Yeah, definitely this, establishing just how strong Fate is.
Yeah. The second half of the chapter deals with Setsuna fighting with the crazy moon girl that uses the same type of swordsmanship.
Tsukuyomi?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And their fight, which is kind of it features a small flashback when we find out that Tsukuyomi is allowing herself to be possessed by a demon blade, but should be a pretty good fight coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's got a demon sword for that extra power, and it'll be an appropriate, like, end fight between two characters who have been longtime rivals and foils to each other.
Right. I mean, they're very much swordsmen of the same school, but are opposite in every aspect.
Also both attracted to girls.
Also both attracted to girls.
Yeah, some of that dialogue was interesting.
Yeah. When Setsuna is asked what has prompted her to improve her sword skills, and she blushes, and then at the end, when Tsukuyomi is talking about how she intends to devour her, and
that wasn't even the only note. But let's this is a PG show.
Leave it there. let it drop.
Yeah, that was interesting. I mean, honestly, I think that's a PG magazine too. I don't. Yeah, I found that odd. But I have to say that the fight does look pretty promising, because not just because it's an interesting matchup, but because of the pacing. I think that it's going to get exactly the right amount of focus and the right amount of time focused on that. Just a good couple of characters to focus on for two, maybe three chapters. Probably more like two, though, because this one only got a half.
Yeah,
right.
Just let it be paced adequately.
Mm-hmm. You pointed out you thought that there might be a cameo.
Yeah, I thought that in the flashback, the one who was teaching Setsuna was Motoko from Love Hina. And I mean, it's known fact that Shinmeiryu, the art they practice, is the same. It's the same thing in both series.
Right.
They have the same attacks. Cool. And
I think, personally, I think it could be Motoko's older sister. I just think, because of her haircut, specifically, and, like, her face, it looked more... If it is a cameo, it could just be an original character, obviously.
Right.
But if it is a character, if it is a cameo, pardon me, I personally believe that it would be Motoko's older sister. I think she looks more similar to her than to Motoko, specifically.
Have we ever gotten confirmation from Akamatsu about whether or not they take place in the same universe?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'm not too caught up on that kind of...
Yeah, I'm not certain on Word of God about anything like that. I mean, beyond knowing that it's the same sword style.
Right.
The question has been raised, anyway.
Yeah. If you happen to know this, shonenbeam@gmail.com, please let us know. We would appreciate that. Siren, chapter 135. What happened in this one, Drew?
Well, we saw the last of Vigo's fight with the senator character, and he gets solidly chopped up and extracted. But meanwhile, while he does that, it gives Mari time to not only run away from the immediate area, but also, like, break the psychic block that's been preventing her from contacting Shao.
Mm-hmm.
So now she is at least in contact with Shao and Kabuto, so...
That is a major point out of the way.
Yeah, that's... As far as, like, rescue arcs go, that means they only need to save the hostages, because so long as Shao is in communication with Mari, there shouldn't really be much of a problem in that way.
I wouldn't think
getting them back together.
Yeah.
And then we also get a lot of Moroku's past, and a lot of allegory about wolves and sheep, which was not that comprehensible to me. But
no.
Apparently he spoke to aliens in the meteor, or spoke to the senator who did. And there is something actually named Sephiroth.
Yeah. I have to agree with you. A lot of this was frankly just incomprehensible, and I'm a little bit disappointed by that because there's been all of this has been so interesting, but at the same time, Siren has really, really obviously been struggling to capture the imagination of the readers, as you can see from its position at the table of contents week to week. To bring out something like this, an allegory to some convoluted story that makes practically no sense whatsoever, that's not how you're going to bring in readers.
Yeah, I feel like that was a bit forced. I feel like it's more so just because he's trying to wrap up Moroku quickly.
Right.
And he doesn't have the time that he would have liked otherwise to work that in the way he would have liked to. And then in the end, Ageha's just behind him, so get ready for some fights, I guess.
I do have to appreciate if you're right in saying that this is Iwashiro Toshiaki's way of kind of getting a pseudo backstory out of the way just so we can get to the main fight involving Moroku. I would appreciate its brevity because that's not even one full chapter to get that out of the way to then let the fight start.
Oh, it's definitely been a fast-paced climax to this arc as far as like stuff happening all the time and constantly and not getting too bogged down.
Mm-hmm.
It's been really good in that way.
So yeah, now we have the standoff. Ageha's standing right behind Moroku, already powering up Melchsey's door. You're right in saying it's gone so fast. I can't even really just stop and appreciate the moment. I mean, this is kind of what we've been waiting for the whole series, but it doesn't feel like we should be there yet. It's so rushed.
Yeah, it's been rushed. That's sort of not the author's fault, but I'll give it a chance. I'll see the actual fight, see how it's written.
Mm-hmm. All right, Zettai Kaden Children, Chapter 231, which has seen the series itself has seen a flurry of conversation on the site recently.
Yeah, recently, particularly me and the one other commentator, Mario. Thank you for all your feedback. It has been very interesting to talk about ZKC. I've had several conversations online about the manga. I've never met an opinion like quite like yours. I've met people who do really like it for the drama. They exist, and they're on the MAL discussion forums. But at the same time, it is nice to see people who are liking the more comedic aspect of it because it puts it in a different perspective for me liking it, hearing why other people like the show. And it's interesting that you do find that like the parenting issue for you more just enhances the comedy rather than the drama. I can definitely see that. I do believe that like the basis of good comedy is having strong connections between characters. So I definitely see where you're coming from, and I really appreciate your feedback. Onward to the chapter, we have Phantom Daughter being trapped inside the spirit photograph, where she could escape from, but doing so would make it very obvious to Espers in the area that she had done so,
right,
and thereby exposing her identity. So it's sort of a psychological trap. We get a little bit of introspection from her, where like she felt what she was doing was wrong, but she just didn't want to disobey her father, which to me feels kind of token, not that important. And then Maid Cafe.
Yep. And thumb wrestling, which is that?
That's a thing. It is a thing.
I've read a lot of series that involve Maid Cafe as the kind of kitschy little fun way for, you know, a little bit of fan service, a little bit of romantic comedy, etc. Can't say I've read these series having thumb wrestling moments before. Maybe that's just me, but that was a surprise.
Yeah, I guess like it's one of those things that maid cafes do that turn some otaku on, or I guess Kaoru too, because she counts for that. It was such a good like retro Kaoru moment to just have her tightly crumpling up the ticket to the maid cafe.
Yeah,
and then it was also a good Sakaki Yo moment to have them both caught in a thumb wrestling match with guys in maid uniforms.
That was pretty fun, actually.
Pretty solid, and not a whole lot else to this chapter, but enjoyable, if nothing else, for the maid cafe moment.
Well, there was the little moment of the picking the grain of rice off of Kaoru's cheek. Just another little hint at just reaffirming Kaoru's feelings, obviously.
Getting towards the more romantic side, yes.
I want to touch on something else that Mario said. I haven't had much to contribute to your conversation, but I have been reading it over. And I really want to bring up to everyone the concept of Hyobu as a villain and whether or not he has enough credibility as a villain. I found that take on it extremely interesting because I have to strongly agree that I don't feel that he is a credible villain, given that he's had so much face time with all of the protagonists, and he's he's so friendly, and reasonably, he's so friendly to the three girls. It makes sense for him to be with the way that the plot has been set up. But in my opinion, as an unfortunate side effect of that, he's so overly familiar to me now that I just can't really place faith in him as our true villain of the series. And yet, if it isn't him, who is it?
I mean, I feel like we have seen little hints of who the actual villain in series is, particularly from the one Minamoto flashback where he was back in college with Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like if anything's going to be the problem, it's going to be the government eventually experimenting on the Espers,
mm-hmm.
because that was brought up as a thing. I feel like more so than any of the characters we know, because they've been shown to have their own well-motivated, if nothing else, reasons for doing things. Kyobu has his prejudices that have been simmering for 80 years, and Phantom Daughter just has parental issues, so right. I don't think either of those are strong enough for the kind of are strong enough villains for the kind of plot that ZKC is building up, which is like just trying to alter the future. I think the future is a more inanimate kind of villain, and because of that, it demands a greater villain than just one character, especially like the kinds of characters we've had thus far.
Okay, yeah, I can see that. I would definitely be a lot more pleased with the series as a whole if Hyobu's role was not to be the ultimate villain. In that regard, if I stop viewing him as just a cookie-cutter, stereotypical kind of evil bad guy villain, but rather as a character who just has different motives, different agendas from a lot of the other characters, and that places him in the mindset that he currently is, that really facilitates a lot of the other plots. So I can respect that point of view. I suppose that the only thing I could say to that in response would be that unfortunately, we haven't had enough development of the government plot to this point, to where Kyobu right now feels like if I had to pick one villain, it's him right now. And that I would feel is a weak point. But I definitely share your opinion that overall, it could end up being the government. And in that sense, I would really enjoy that.
Yeah, I do think like there is potential for expansion as far as villainy goes. There's Black Phantom, which is just too over-the-top villainy to be the final boss, and Hyobu, who is too friendly and too much of an agenda that is Esper-friendly in particular, to be the final boss.
Right. Yeah, thanks again, Mario. You've been immensely helpful.
You've been great.
You've done good, kid. You've done good. And seriously, you've been fantastic. We really appreciate it. All right, moving on. Good ending, chapter 51. There's no positive segue into good ending 51.
I thought Adachi didn't publish in magazine. I thought he was Sunday.
Sir, you sully the good name of Mitsuru Adachi comparing him to this chapter. Baseball.
Yep.
Baseball.
Baseball and, like, a weird pairing starting to develop.
Yeah, I was always kind of hoping that Eri would be more involved romantically, but I was kind of hoping with Seiji, because who the hell is this guy?
Yeah.
I care about him. This is like the first and probably one of the last chapters where he's going to matter. He's certainly never going to get another entire chapter of just focusing on him and what he does.
Well, not after like he kept pitching for three more innings with like a wounded shoulder.
Yeah, that.
I mean, I feel like that was just a bit taken too far.
Yeah.
Like to have someone keep pitching like that after a shoulder injury, which could seriously affect your career. No. I think you could have. Yeah.
Now he's never going to be able to hit 160 kilometers per hour.
You guys,
no, he will not.
Enough. This is not. Don't compare Adachi to this, please. Adachi is amazing.
But yeah, I feel like the same scene they had at the end could have been accomplished just as well if he had been injured and out for the last three innings.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like it sends a more negative message that way.
Yeah, I just overall, like, you know my opinion. I think you share it, if I'm not mistaken, that I don't really want to see any more of Toru, but it is rather jarring to go from that plot to just an entire chapter of baseball and no mention whatsoever of what's been going on the last few chapters.
I guess I would like it a bit more if it was tying into a future arc rather than just being the one-off chapter, because right now we're just going back to Toru. That said, this was a comparatively good chapter because the guy who writes good endings, Sasuga K, is not horrible, and this was a decent enough premise, even if it was totally ripped from a certain someone. Good chapter for good ending, considering it did not feature Seiji, really.
Yeah, I just honestly, I lost interest within the first couple pages the moment I read that Yuki wasn't going to be there. That's the plot that I want to see resolved in some kind of positive fashion, and I really don't care at all about this baseball guy, sorry. I have no interest whatsoever.
That's understandable. It was as close to a filler chapter as you could get, really.
Kimi no Iramachi, chapter 106.
Also a filler chapter.
Really? Are you sure about that? a few things happen in the beginning. Kiyomi decides it's time to go home because they can't be staying there for New Year's. They'd be inconveniencing Haruto and his family far too much. So Haruto realizes this is entirely too abrupt. He didn't really have the time to plan to how to confront Mishima over the entire awkwardness of their current standing, relationship, non-relationship, what have you. And then quite a bit of emphasis is placed on that meeting. She confronts him at first because he's unable to fall asleep at night, thinking over all of this, and she happens to knock on the door and call him out to go outside with her. And she presents the idea that she had originally said of why doesn't he just go to college with her? And she kind of backtracks on that and says, you know, you should maybe think about not going, but not in a negative way. It was more in a way that she is falling in love with him far too much and far too quickly for the way that Haruto is treating her, and she just can't bear to be around him because she's hurting herself too much.
Which, I mean, it was great, especially, like, coming to this out of good ending.
Oh, yeah.
It's just such a dramatic other-tier difference of writing quality.
Just incredible improvement.
And then just Haruto's response at the end, which is just...
Yeah.
This is developed fast, but it's felt so in character for everyone.
It has. That's the amazing thing that I have to say. After just being stuck in the mire of week-to-week drama for so long, after focusing on Eba for so long, after everything with Kazuma going on, again, for so long, this has been comparatively just a breakneck pace, but you're absolutely right. No one has felt out of character whatsoever, and it's positive for once. And everything is developing well. The ending of the chapter that you alluded to is that Haruto finally just kind of cuts her off with an embrace. And says, you know, don't think like that because I've been thinking of dating.
Yeah,
you.
You're cute. I want to go out with you.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Solid in character and a very enjoyable romance read.
I know that you have not read Suzuka. I have, and it still remains because who knows how.
Actually, believe it or not, I've got the DVD box in the mail right now.
Excellent.
So
that the
I will.
Incidental note, that is a anime original ending, but still actually pretty good.
Okay.
Still definitely worth a watch. Regarding Suzuka, by the way, is the previous series by the same author, Seo Koji. And obviously I have no idea how Kimi no Iramachi is going to end. As of right now, Suzuka remains the only romantic comedy series with an ending that I liked. And I feel that plot in Suzuka really began to develop positively when the main character, Akitsuki Yamato, started dating Honoka, another person, not the main love interest. This is kind of what we have right now. Haruto is beginning to date someone who we didn't really see as the main love interest for...
Or, like, at all for a year and a half after the series started.
Exactly. So I'm hoping that he can kind of recapture his old magic of being able to really develop a very interesting plot. I'm not necessarily saying this to say that Mishima is the wrong choice and that Eba's going to come back into it, or Kanzaki or anybody else. Who knows which direction this is going to go. But, you know, just judging on Koji's own past history, I have to say that I find this very promising for the future of the series. Certainly, standalone, just this own chapter, fantastic.
Yes.
Absolutely. SWAT 10 is not fantastic. SWAT the series is not fantastic.
It's 99.9% like iShield 21, only not as good.
So,
in terms of losing percentage.
I am of the opinion that this is getting close to being worse than Bleach.
It might already be there for me.
Because
at least the first 10 chapters of Bleach, I was still like, this series has promise. I already don't think that SWAT has any promise whatsoever. There's no way that this series can be salvaged.
Even removing the knowledge that it's at the bottom of the table of contents and likely to be canceled, completely taking that out of the equation, this is still just absolute garbage, in my opinion. And comparing it to Bleach, Bleach had one rather good, rather enjoyable arc. If Bleach had ended at the end of Soul Society, I would have called it a good series. Not great, not mediocre. I would have called it a good series. This SWAT has nothing even remotely resembling that. And also, it has achieved in 10 chapters what Bleach took hundreds to achieve. This kind of hatred that it evokes from me.
How can a series become stagnant in 10 chapters? How can the pacing ruin it in 10 chapters?
I don't feel like it's stagnancy that's ruining it. It's just horribly, horribly bad cliched writing and characters that we don't care about. I think that's the key for me. Like, if the characters were at least moderately entertaining, if they even had quirks on the level of, say, Lock On, this might be actually, like, tolerable to read. The characters are so one-dimensional, they're actually not even point particles. They just don't exist to me.
It's
beyond dead to me.
It's ridiculous. And it's not even consistent. The first 8 chapters, it was a delinquent series. The last 2 chapters, it's suddenly like Street Fighter. They're just throwing off Hadoukens left and right. Yeah. What is going on?
I have no idea.
Wait, did you say they're throwing off Hadoukens left and right? Not down, diagonal down, and then right?
Oh, yes, pardon me. It's quarter circle to the right, and then, you know, strong. I don't even have words. Okay, let's attempt to do this semi-properly. Mm-hmm. What happened in this chapter? Oh, the monster boss guy has a very brief flashback for some reason, super brief. And then he's fighting Manabizaki Kyo, and he has a 99.9% chance of winning. And then he's about to throw his final attack, and the little helper buddy guy jumps in the way, takes the attack, and gives one of those stupid little, well, as long as there's 0.1% of a chance, you still have to fight speeches.
To me, that was especially frustrating, because it felt like the whole scene was, like, grafted right out of the Shinryuji match in Eye Shield 21.
Nah.
Not in terms of the action, but just in terms of the writing. There's just so much that was just directly ripped off, from, like, the short guy taking major hits to, like, the 99.9% chance of losing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the sole reason that tiny flashback was in there was so that there could be a flashback to add to the negative comments you could make about the chapter.
I think we're going about this all wrong. It's actually a gag series. Jaguar ended, it needed a replacement.
It's a deliberate parody of everything we find terrible in Shonen.
Oh, my. So, yeah, well, we haven't even gotten to the worst part. Well, or perhaps the 99.9 was the worst in your eye.
Maybe we'll time skip past this fight.
The worst part of the chapter, in my opinion, is the end of the chapter when Manabizaki, with this 0.1% chance of pulling through with a victory, uses, what's it called,
reverse resolve.
So he goes, within one chapter, he goes from saying, I can't possibly learn this technique, which was explained to be like an electrical discharge, so it is canonically supernatural. Now, it wasn't just a trick involving like dust or something. It is canonically supernatural.
Stronger than making girls kneel in a bathroom.
Which was ripped off from Madoka Box. Oh my god, this is a terrible show. Series. Thank god it's not a show. But yeah, within one chapter from going from I can't possibly construct a formula to imitate this and fight back to having the ability to do the inverse of it to like magic cancel effectively. I don't even have words.
I don't know how to do it, but I know exactly how to stop it.
Oh my god.
I don't know.
I'm thinking guns.
Is this the worst series of the year?
Certainly, like, started within this year.
Yeah,
I would so much have rather Lock On continued. I was not a fan of Lock On.
Neither was I. I would have preferred that. I would have preferred Yotsuya. And I railed on that for weeks as just being a terrible ripoff of Neuro. That would have been better than this. What, Shonen Shiku? We didn't even get to read. I read one chapter. It was mediocre. That's better than this. What else was this year? I know there was something else.
Hunter x Hunter is better.
Shut up.
Hunter x Hunter is better than this series while on hiatus.
Yeah, that's kind of true.
If there were just blank pages.
It's not actively causing pain.
It would be better.
If there were just blank pages with Hunter x Hunter written at the top of them, I would enjoy that more than SWAT.
That's chapter 311. I believe that occurs.
Oh my god, I hope that comes back soon. I hope anything replaces this. What a miserably awful series.
Double issue of Bleach? All the time? You did say anything.
Okay, you know what? Yes. Yeah. You know what? I come to think of it, yes, I will stand by that statement. I would prefer a second of chapter of Bleach per week than SWAT continuing.
That would also result statement. In Bleach ending quicker, so it's a win-win.
There you go.
That is true. Like, if we think about it that way, then yes, I would prefer it.
That would probably have to, in some way, improve pacing. So, yeah. Wow, let's move on. Enigma, Chapter 2, a new series that is not horrifyingly awful. In Enigma, Chapter 2, we get to see a little bit of application of these characters' powers in this circumstance. The characters are finally getting around to trying to get out of this building, and they try again while walking around the building, trying doors and windows. Obviously, nothing like that works. But then the student council president tries to get them all to unite, because one of the ideas that was tossed around was everyone splitting up and looking for the seven passwords. So they arrive at this door with a typewriter on it, weirdly, which obviously each of the seven characters has to enter their own password to be able to pass through. There are seven passwords hidden in the school somewhere. Rather than splitting up, they unite. They're going to wander around together. And then one of the shadows that has been alluded to by Enigma... or Enigma. It still weirds me out. Mm-hmm. One of the shadows abducts the student council president during the course of action here. And interestingly, I found this bit really rather interesting, was the panic code that was issued over the PA system. It was something like a Yamamoto-kun, you know, we need to see you come to the office. I don't remember the exact quote.
Yeah, it was
quote.
Like, Takahashi-san is here, all the students should come out to meet him.
Yes, thank you. And that's actually a secret code that was in the student's handbook at that school, where if that's said over the PA, it actually means that there is someone unauthorized in the school who means to do harm. Everyone needs to, you know, be safe. That little tidbit in and of itself, I found that really good.
Just for that made it, at least the chapter was a nice touch. Coming from a school that had a similar code phrase that students had to memorize in case somebody broke in, because... of course, it was a school where people afraid of that. It felt like a very nice touch and just a well-researched tidbit. So clearly there was at least effort being poured into this by the author.
Yeah, very, very pleased with that. Ultimately, then, they're kind of panicking as the student council president has been taken away by the shadow. And all of a sudden, Sumio starts to feel drowsy, and he falls asleep, and he begins writing in his dream diary, and the dream diary reveals the location of one of these passwords. But it's not just a word written on a piece of paper, it's a picture. And there's a clue that one of the people in the picture has the password written on, I suppose, on the front of his jacket or what have you.
On a name tag.
On a nameplate,
right.
Yeah.
But there's actually another person in the picture in front of that person. And they don't exactly know how they're going to handle this. A further read of the dream diary reveals that it's going to have to be the character with the eye patch on who's going to need to erase. That's the illusion.
Yeah, we can only see a little bit of the text in the dream diary.
But presumably he has an ability that will erase the person in front of the picture.
Right, which that... we have no concrete idea of what that power is just yet, but that's an interesting idea.
It's an interesting way to apply a power that hopefully has broader standards. But just by itself, it's certainly... it's interesting as far as just introducing powers go, and if you want to have a good shonen, good mystery, or good battle, you want to have interesting powers.
Right. So this chapter, Chapter 2, certainly did not have the overly derivative feeling of the first chapter.
At the same time, I think it needs to be said, introducing this, like, a different power take, and they need to work together, pool their different powers to overcome the adversity they're facing, is another segment from Mirai Nikki.
Well, that's also just another segment from Shonen.
Yeah.
Well, yes. But
I suppose given that it's taken from Mirai Nikki.
I get the part that you're talking about. Yeah, it feels a little bit like Mirai Nikki, but it felt less derivative in this chapter. Like, more so, it felt like at least the author was getting into her own sense of writing it.
Right.
His. Sakaki Kenji. What?
But I thought you said it was a disciple of the person who wrote Reborn.
She's a woman. What? The Reborn author is a woman. Not every disciple must be female. the chapter to me felt a lot less shockingly derivative. I completely believe what you say about the comparison to Mirai Nikki, but the most overt comparison is just the Dream Diary itself. Now that I have to accept that as just being part of the series, the shock value has kind of worn off. I'm not to say that I'm okay with that. But Chapter 2, I was able to just read as a chapter unto itself, not so much as a comparison to something else. And in that sense, it was certainly far more enjoyable, at least in my opinion.
It was well done. It was nowhere near the other new series.
Well, yeah. Yes.
Are we saying that in a good way or a bad way?
A good way, yes. Yeah. It is many times above that other series.
I feel like it's setting itself up for like moderate table of contents success, at least as far as readability goes in this chapter.
I think simply, honestly, just the baseline fact that it's a mystery series means that it has a chance of survival. Now, obviously, Yotsuya did not survive, but just... Yotsuya had every chance to survive based on that same baseline fact as well. It was just, frankly, so bad that it worked against itself. This has it, but it seems to be building on it in a more interesting fashion and in a more shonen fashion, because as much as I disliked Yotsuya, I do have to say that it was very alternative compared to shonen standards, so that could have worked against it very actively. This feels like a lot more of a shonen mystery series.
This really has a feel to it like it could it could stay around for a while and do okay in the table of contents.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like it's got an immediate like 10-20 chapter arc and then something that'll maybe carry on for a little longer.
Yeah, there's definitely different points of intrigue that are long-term plots. The disappearance of his mother... you know, lots of different little things that I'm curious to find out. And certainly, if I'm not exactly the target audience, I imagine some other people are far more interested. All right, that concludes the group discussion segment. Time now for the individual series that I read. Air Gear 288, which had some interesting fan service shots of the girl that's body swapped with President Obama. Or, pardon me, John Omaha. So the our 44th president of the United States is an action hero in the tightest... Small. I wouldn't even call it shorts at that point. Wow. Oh, great. You've outdone yourself once again. But the bulk of this chapter is a setup for an Onigiri fight, which, frankly, I cannot be bothered to care about that whatsoever. He's, to me, the single least interesting and one-dimensional character in the series. I get that he's perverted. That does not amuse me in the slightest. Clearly, it amuses an author whose entire motivational focus is to draw fan service characters. So perhaps a little bit of a self-insert there for perverted points of view, but overall, really a rather uninteresting chapter. After the initial joke, after the novelty of President Obama and a girl wears off once again, the Onigiri stuff was just not that interesting. Bloody Monday Season 2, Chapter 41, was the realization by Alexei that he has been betrayed, and that moment was actually rather fantastic. There was more to this chapter with the conversation between Fujimaru and Hibiki, but mostly the standout moment to me from this chapter was Snow White and Alexei realizing that they've been betrayed, and Snow White being painted as a hostage when she's actually one of the terrorists, but Alexei's last-ditch attempt to have his message and mission carry on is to trick the counterterrorism unit into thinking that Snow White is just a hostage that he has taken. So she is now going to still be free to enact whatever it is that he would have her do. So she's going to be a third party. She's certainly not with the counterterrorists, but she's not on the side of the terrorists anymore after Peter Pan has betrayed them. So a great moment there solidifying the establishment of a new overall antagonist. Defense Devil Chapter 65, we're still in soccer land. This is the further freeing of Ida Maria as Kukabara has come down and he's further enacting his plan. And a lot of focus on the character known as Y, the letter Y in this chapter. I apparently was right in not knowing her name previously because it's just a letter and I would have remembered that. But she's turned coat, sort of. She's revealed her hand to Bikula. In showing that the potion that she gave to Kukabara earlier actually was a poison, and she kicks Bikula out of the way, but Kukabara saves her from impending disaster from the naive devils. So who knows exactly where she's going to stand right now? Perhaps she's due for a good turn. Gintama Chapter 324 was an incredible parody of recent Jump events, the One Piece hiatus, where Gintama hasn't gone on hiatus, but it was away for 1 week, and in that 1 week, everyone has progressed 2 years. They even make an overt, direct reference saying that in that 1 week, they've made a promise to meet again in 2 years at Shabandi Archipelago. Just a fantastic series of amazing jokes. Gintoki has longer hair and he has a cross-shaped scar and another scar over his eye. Sadaharu is now a man, just a human man who's actually evolved from a boil that grew on Sadaharu. Kagura is kind of older and more voluptuous in a way. Otosan gang are also boil men. Just unbelievable comedy. Capped off with a hilarious moment as Shinpachi is just is serving as the straight man because he did not age and or mature and or evolve with all of these others. He's still just Shinpachi. And there's a great moment as he runs away. He's all heartbroken over the world around him having changed, and he doesn't fit in anymore. And he just goes home, and he's crying to himself. And Otaya-san kind of hears him and asks if she can help. And she delivers a very almost motherly speech, obviously being his sister, but almost motherly sort of speech explaining the ways of the world and everything's going to be okay. And he's so moved by this. He says something to the effect of, oh, as long as everything is okay with you, then I'm going to be fine. All's right with the world. And he rushes out to give her a hug, and she's married to Kondo now. And he starts bleeding. Does a bleeding spit take from it. Just a brilliantly funny chapter. Amazing chapter. And what was not an amazing chapter is Reborn, chapter 307, which is more of the Ryohei fight. All right, now let me go over this with you guys again. So you see, Ryohei, when he takes damage, he builds up his meter even more to be able to output more damage. So he's almost dead by the end of this chapter, but his meter is full, so he can then attack again. This is like a solid month of this incredibly boring character fighting another boring character, both of which have boring powers. And this is the first of like five consecutive fights we're in line for.
He's using Bide over and over again.
Yes. This is just so bad. This is an obvious video game cliche ripoff. And this is just the first fight in all of this. And they're fighting for pride. The art is nonsensical. Just wow.
Do you think if they were fighting for pride, you'd think they'd go somewhere more towards the body blows? Because, you know, they're trying to get the knees to drop down.
They actually say that. That is an actual point of contention in this.
Wait, really?
Yes, not joking.
What?
Aoba does point out, you remember our agreement, right? If one knee touches the ground, the fight's over.
What, really?
It is sort of a boxing match.
That is O great. That is not so great. That is O great.
It's O bad, actually. It is incredibly poor, and I am not looking forward to more fun. Because you know exactly what's going to happen. This fight's going to take a month. Whenever the Gokudera Ship P fight happens, it's going to take a month or two. Hibari's fight will take a while. But Lambo will get shit. Lambo will get nothing. Lambo, the best character in the damn series, will get absolutely nothing and be relegated to just a very, very brief cameo joke mention. That is not okay with me. All right, well, that concludes. There's no positive way to move out of that, but let's do so. That concludes the This Week in Manga chapter discussion segment. Let's now focus on our chapters of the week. Clint.
My chapter of the week was Naruto 511. It was a very well-done flashback that brought closure to the end of the three ninja that we have come to know, brought some closure to Conan's death, and it was just very well done, the art style used in ways that aren't normally done by other people.
True.
My chapter of the week was Kakashi 322. It's just the end result of a series worth of build-up, and just felt extremely satisfying, and again, a great in-character moment from two well-developed central characters.
And for me, my chapter of the week was Gintama chapter 324. These two can vouch because I read the chapters as they were here for pre-show. I laughed unbelievably hard several times. Just brilliantly, brilliantly funny stuff from Sorachi once again. That concludes the show. We're so glad that we could have brought you an episode this week. We should again be on regular schedule going forward. So no absence after all. No hiatus from us to meet again at Sorbonne Archipelago in the future. Thank you very much for listening. Final flash.
The main character is a sword.
Dreamin', don't give it up, John.
Cream truckers! Thanks very much for listening. Good night.